Feeling a little run down by the Discourse and Rider fandom? Looking for something fresh to put that bounce in your step and a bee in your bonnet? Well, look no further than the Uncommon Cast RX. Active ingredients. GOMSQ.
Because everything I hate, I do say it should be better, and it would be nice if I just say...
Illustrator Clay.
Fire.
MC Pez. I am the child of the sun of my grandpa. Side effects may include hysteritis, show a fever, helper robotophobia, and an English stroke. This is the cure for the Kamen Rider Show. Dose as needed. Hello, listeners. If I didn't actually say hello to you already, this is the Messiah of Love, and Gomez Q and Illis Claire are here with me, and we're talking about Kiva for the third time. I think I'm tentatively and amateurishly calling this the third bite, or something ridiculous like that, so... Yeah, we're going to be talking about Kiva episodes 15 through 22. Before we get into the content of our third bite of Kiva, there are some loose ends I would like to tie. I am making brief statements only. If you want me to explain, Claire and Todd, ask and I will. My love for Otoya is rooted in my longing for parental redemption.
Yeah, I think open it up if you want to. People can probably intuit something from that, but if you... If you want to go for it, then go for it. Like I've been saying, I think the personal anecdote stuff is good to have in Kamen Rider commentary, but it's up to you.
Most institutions frown on anecdotal evidence, but
sure, that's why we don't give a degree at the end of end of Kiva.
No, I think I get entirely where he's coming from. I think we've dealt with parental redemption before, to a small extent, but I mean. Yeah, we've all got a different thing to talk about when it comes to this show, and if there's something that elicits a particularly strong reaction, go with it.
I don't really want to provide a lot of detail, just because I don't think that would be kind to anybody, but basically, like, there was a point in my life when I was much younger where I considered... not emancipating myself, but moving away to another state to live with an aunt and uncle.
Right.
And I don't remember who was the cause at the time, but both of my biological progenitors can be blamed at different points in my life for wanting me, or for me wanting to, whether it was ridiculous and overreacting or not, providing the, I guess, fuel for me to want to move away and... just not be around them. But things have changed, thank God, and I'm very happy about that. Go ahead.
You've done it both. You've been a child and a parent, which Claire and I haven't, so I do think you have you'd have plenty to say about this, and maybe, you know, if you put it into words, succinct words at some point, I think it'd be good to hear.
Mm.
But that might take a long time, you know, that's up to you.
It's, Sorry, go on.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm ready yet to speak on, I guess, Otoya's side.
Right, okay.
Or from his perspective just yet. But I think we get a glimpse of that when he comes back into Wataru's body. And he seemed very paternal towards Megumi and... I don't remember if he realized that he was in his son's body or not. I kind of think he did. Mm-hmm. And the steps that he took and the changes that he made, I get and I understand, because you kind of want to, or at least I do, kind of want to make a miniature version of yourself, but improve upon the current state of your design.
Yeah.
but in a good way. Like, I would like my children to have all of... Especially... It's difficult when you see so many of your own qualities in them to not want to push that a little bit further.
Okay.
And if I was, me personally, if I was a standard American parent, you know, it would be, you know, Barbies and My Little Pony and stuff, but my older daughter plays with, you know, Kamen Riders and still watches Disney movies, but, you know, I dress up as a dinosaur and she attacks me with her sword and shield, and then we have tea with, you know, Shadow Moon and...
Do it all, why not?
A Care Bear, you know? And, like, most people don't, you know, some people, I think, would be afraid to do those sorts of things with their, you know, daughter, because you don't want to confuse and you don't want to mix things up, and it's an antiquated and silly notion.
But I don't know. I very much see a lot of myself in her, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but I'd like to encourage those things.
I definitely understand it from a teacher-student perspective, yeah. And I think that's as close as I'll ever come to what you feel. But I do believe it's this idea of being able to confuse a child or a student. If you mean what you're saying, you won't confuse them. And, yeah. And it's all based in very old ignorances and prejudices, the idea of confusing them, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's about all I want to say on that subject, unless were there questions, Claire?
No, I was just going to say that obviously it's up to you in your case, but you're saying that, like, whether that was based on in overreaction or something, like, it probably wasn't, because what is overreaction if you are an unhappy teenager and your parents are upsetting you? Like, you don't have to be like, as an adult, I definitely agree with my decisions of the time, but I don't think you need to feel obliged to say maybe I was overreacting.
The scales
just
are so different.
Yeah, like, I think it would be probably kinder to yourself to just be like, have that younger me.
Yeah, I can see that, and it's a good perspective you bring, that you don't, taking that point of view or philosophy allows for a lot of gentleness and forgiveness with yourself, because it's okay, you were a different person at that time, and all those things can be true for that person then, but they don't need to be now.
Yeah.
And it frees you from the past.
Right. Yeah, like Wataru.
Break the chain.
Right. Right. Yeah, I've been obsessed with that notion lately, and it's just, like, dominating me, which is great, I love it. But I'll share more on that later. Ohimura's self-denial can and should be read, in my opinion, as rising above one's bad habits or evil inclinations, not necessarily as denying his identity, although who knows what Inoue was thinking.
Yeah. Can't argue with that one, really.
Yeah, I was a bit all over the place with Ohimura, because I don't know... Like, it's the whole analogy thing. Sometimes it's valid to have a supernatural stand-in for some genuine problem, but sometimes it just confuses the matters, because if Ohimura's, like, if his problems, like, if his desire to eat people is supposed to be, like, reflective of being a compulsive murderer or something, like, I don't really know where it's coming from. I don't know if being born a thing that makes you want to feed from people is really transferable to the human experience. It's quite tricky, because there are a lot of...
It's a very broad analogy,
qualifiers, I think, on that.
It's a very broad analogy, but it is the classic vampire thing, or vegan vampire thing.
Right, and that's why I kind of felt... I wanted to address it, just because I wanted to clarify that, like, I don't feel like it's really... transferable, and maybe I didn't say that well, but I mean, you certainly did, so thanks, I guess.
Teamwork.
Yay, alright. Okay, and then this is more going into these episodes, but editing the last one reminded me of this. There is an anime from the 90s that succeeds where this show fails regarding women being people and having power and choosing between two guys, I think, maybe. Ooh. Even though I haven't seen all of Kiva and it's been a few years, but are you familiar with Ceres Celestial Legend, or Ayashi no Ceres?
No.
Yeah, I remember seeing people's icons of it back when LiveJournal was real.
Wow. Okay. That's a good memory. Not because LiveJournal...
It's oddly specific.
...was a million years ago, but just impressed that you sort of recognised it.
Well, because Sarah's Celestial has a sort of certain feel...
It sticks in your mind?
Right.
Sarah's... It's a tongue twister, so it stands out.
Okay. No, I've never heard of it.
Okay, and I think I was looking it up and actually acquired it recently, and the
from the shop.
Yeah, the place where I was acquiring it, somebody made a comment about about how I think they were saying that it was made by the guy who made Fushigi Yugi, which I heard, like, stay away from that because there's bad things. Okay. I was told that by, like, a 15-year-old girl in high school, though, so I don't quite know what she was talking about. And I never pursued it. I heard there are very attractive males in that.
I've heard that too.
Yeah, I don't know. But, like, in this show, there are two guys, and they're... It's kind of the Jiro Otoya thing. And let me see. I wrote down this comment specifically. The guys both love the lead and become friends because of that. They become friends with each other. And I hope to see something similar happen with Jiro, and I meant Otoya, not Yuri. And it may be cliche, but I like it. I liked it then in high school when I saw it, and I think I like how the two of them draw closer in this stretch of episodes, too. I mean, I know I like it.
I can appreciate the sentiment, so long as it doesn't exclude the woman in the picture. You know, so long as they all end up friends. I think the focus on the masculine friendship part is just the only thing that bugs me.
Okay. That sounds kind of heavy. Like, I don't think I'd want to be friends with two guys who both fancy me.
Really? Well, the implication is they'd be over you. It would eventually, and everyone would be fine, and you'd all be equals.
Oh.
But I don't... It's veering quite far into... well, there's no way other way to say it. Rose before hose territory, which is a place that I never want to see in anything.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a trite...
God.
Well, it's a trite argument. I don't... You know, beyond being a stupid phrase. It's just, you're having the wrong argument. Never mind the wrong answer. It's the wrong question. So as long as it doesn't exclude the object of the affections.
No, it's definitely, like, she makes a choice, and the guy who doesn't get chosen has to deal with it, and then he becomes friends. Like, he sees how much he and the chosen one have in common,
right.
And, like, she's really the fulcrum of their relationship, and, but, like, not, she's not used, she just happens to be the fulcrum, okay. And it's, I think it really balances out well, but, like I said, I saw it when I was, like, 16 or 17, so I can't quite remember
it that
well.
I'd be interested to see it, especially since the role reversed equivalent where two girls who like the same guy become friends is massively cliche and perhaps, you know, should be a great thing, but I don't know.
It makes me bum.
It's, well, I think it's just, I can't think
just
of an example.
It's often written really cloyingly.
Yeah, I can't, like, put it into words, but it feels like it's...
It gives me the shivers.
There's the core of something good there, but it's always written now in a trite, way, just really...
Because sometimes it will end up like
they end up giggling,
the whole I will basically cut off my own feet and my tongue out and everything just so this one person can be happy and I'm totally happy with this because it means it's yucky.
But it usually ends up insulting specifically the female identity of the two women involved. So that's the problem. But anyway, I can't think of any specific examples, so may as well move on.
Yeah. But that sounds cool in the Sarah's Celestial. It's hard. It's hard to say. Sarah's
Celeste. Like series. Like,
yeah, look, it says it right here. Huh?
I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
Sarah's is how I said it, but I believe, that's how the dub says it, so that's how I'm
it's written,
full dub for life.
It's written like series, I guess. Sarah's Celestial Legend. Yeah, that's a something. Okay, well, hey, if it comes up next time I'm at the legitimate video store, maybe I'll consider purchasing it with money.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
I'll pay for it in Rider Coin.
That's it.
I mean, that's how I did pay for it.
That's
anyway.
It. Yeah.
let's move on quickly.
Uh-huh.
I think the NSA is coming.
Bitcoin is real.
Yeah.
Rider Coin is real.
Oh. Yeah, come on, Bitcoin. Well, anyway.
I don't even know what Bitcoin is.
No, I don't know what it is. Never mind.
It's legit.
Never mind.
I could go on. Let's not sidetrack ourselves, but Bitcoin's legit. Okay, let's see. All right, so is there anything, because there's a bunch of noise on behind me, that you guys want to say before we move into the high points that I lined out?
No.
Okay. You need the Messiah of Love to help you out?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, so real quick, I just want to throw out these high points, and we'll go in deeper with stuff. But these things were marked improvements or just stuff I thought was really awesome in this stretch of episodes. Less finisher insert scenes, or whatever you would call those. Otoya calling himself the Messiah of Love in Watcher's body. That was really fun. Just the whole thing. It was when he wasn't in his body, was it? Anyway. Him calling himself Messiah of Love was hilarious, and I loved every second of it. Kengo was awesome. He was looking very dashing, and he was also a very cool guy, and that made me happy. And there was romance and love in both ends of the timeline, and I was really happy about that.
Yay.
in this boys' action show, they find time for it, don't they?
Yeah. I hate maid cafes.
Yeah, oh no, I'm not a fan of
maid
cafes either.
That's something that I need to note.
Yeah, it's creepy and dumb.
Very upsetting.
As highlighted by the inversion of it in, or not the inversion necessarily, but the, you know, gentleman's version in the, in Lion Maru G, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
But also creepy.
okay. let's see. So,
let me just understand something. Edit this out.
okay.
You went through the high points now. You went through them quickly, so if we have something to say about any of those high points, should we say it now or forever hold our peace?
No, you can go ahead and say it now.
I think I know what you mean by finisher insert scenes, the stock footage of the special moves, you mean?
Yes, that is correct.
Was that something that was grating on you in particular?
A little bit. Like I said, one of the reasons I like Rider over Sentai, besides just the fact that it's more awesome, is that it doesn't have all the insert scenes, and like I can totally forgive it in the Showa stuff, but then also...
Oh, well, Kiva's a long as well. Like, it's, you know, possibly amongst the longest special move sequences I've ever seen.
Yeah, which is really irritating, because, like, you know, Hongo would just jump, and there'd be three jump cuts, and then he'd kick the guy, and then he'd explode. And, like, that's cool, because it's so simple and streamlined and really fast, but, yeah, the length of it in Kiva is really difficult to watch, especially with my background. I'm dredging up Digimon again of, you know, loving that show and watching, you know, 4 seasons worth of it a few times over. It's just difficult when, I don't know, 45 seconds at a time are taken up by multiple... insert scenes that we don't really need.
But it's especially interesting with the contrast. I can't wait to see in Kamen Rider Tyson how they reconcile, like, Hongo's strongest finisher against, say, Kiva's strongest finisher, because, like, is Hongo supposed to be as strong? These are the kind of technicalities that I know. It's when people who talk about tech and the magic and stuff in Tokyo, they really get into it, but, like, how strong is that kick?
Real strong.
Real strong. It's gotta be.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see how it's put over. Like, the kick, he kicks somebody with it, and it goes to, like, a flipping x-ray vision, and you see all their bones breaking one after another or something. Like,
hey, that sounds really cool.
What are we talking about here? Anyway.
I actually don't mind the fight stuff, the boring parts in Kiva. Because, and usually I am like, oh, get on with it. Mm-hmm. And I just think that was a big reason why... I stopped caring about Sentai. Mm. But because
the procedural stuff, almost, isn't it? It's the toku procedural.
I suppose. Which is funny, because that's one of my favourite genres.
Well, okay.
Because in Kiva, it's reminding you of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Jiro or Ramon or Ricky come out and turn into their thing and come out, then you're like, they are stuck in there.
And you get a slightly
Why
different look.
Why are they stuck in there? How did they get stuck in there?
Doing?
And you get to see the cool inside of the castle, which makes me think of fun video games.
Sometimes, like, you know, they'll be playing chess, you'll get a slight insight into their personality or something, just because he's changing form, which you didn't get with Agato, for instance.
And you get different outfits.
You do.
Evening wear. That's nice.
Well, if I may...
Of course you may.
I'm fine with those aspects of it. It's the actual, I'm going to do my finishing kick now thing that really bothers me.
Right.
Because, like, they did it, I can't remember what episode it was in, but he was in a forest, and I like seeing the outfits, I like seeing Jiro's sexy little scratch the floor thing. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let's be honest, when guys say something is really cool, it's... And if another guy's doing it, it's really just a code for, like, wow, that looks so studly and hot.
Yeah, we know.
I'm glad you...
Right? Come on.
Accepted.
Come on.
Yeah.
Like, let's just be honest. So, like, that looks really great. And I don't mind those scenes. It's the actual, like, you know, the moon and the castle and the slow jump of the kick. And, like, there's certain aspects of it I like. They did it in an episode where Wachu kicked somebody in the forest. Or maybe he missed them in the forest, but he was trying to kick them. Maybe it was the chameleon guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really trimmed well. Like, okay. It's funny because at first when those insert scenes start happening in a show, it's fine it's fine because it's interesting and new. But after a while, they kind of have to go away. Just like in mathematics, you learn the protracted long way of doing it. Yeah. And then after a while, you're just doing it in your head or whatever. I'm okay with, and I got frustrated with it in school having to learn the long way instead of just doing it fast. But I'm okay with going through the arc, the process of it. But, you know, I hope after this point we see a lot more trimmed versions of those sorts of things.
No, I mean, I like how you put the math thing, and I would have said, like, oh, it's like in martial arts, it's like cultivated ignorance, where you spend a lot of time trying to learn the basic movements of a technique, and then over time it just becomes part of you, and then you start thinking about applications of it. You know, so you kind of get used to the protracted motions, and you cut away the fat, so you've just got this basic raw necessity of the thing. So, I mean, for, like, Kiva's finisher, all you need to, you don't even need to see the whistle thing necessarily. You just definitely need to see, I think, his leg unbinding. I think you need to see those wings spreading. You need to see in front of the moon, maybe, in some way, and then the kick, and that's it. You know, and throwing Kibat flying around and blowing a whistle, and you've got it. It doesn't need to take long at all. It could be just as quick as Hongo's.
Yeah.
So, I'm with you there. But apart from... generally supporting romance and love, I don't know what else I have to say about your few high points. Not few high points, the high points that you laid out very succinctly. I'm glad to see romance and love, of course, because some toku we've described been a bit sparse on the love front.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense.
It's a shame.
What are you going to do?
Well, it's a shame because it goes so naturally with what I'd consider Kamen Rider's basic concept. I know this has mutated a lot over the past 40 years, but the idea of somebody who is essentially an outcast from society and is possessed of a strange or evil power that they have to use for the greater good and grow along the way, how does that not lend itself to romance? How does that not lend itself to touching interpersonal relationships?
Mm.
You know? It shouldn't just be about fighting an evil bad guy. It shouldn't be about talking about a philosophy and then just having a cool fight scene. You know? Let's get some love in there. Let's get some romance in there.
Especially because it's such a large part of the human experience, and the writers, like you alluded to, though they've been changed, they still retain their human heart and soul, and that an integral part of that is love and romance.
So. Especially Heisei writers, who are almost to a man, like teenagers struggling to grow, as opposed to the Showa writers.
Even in the manga, though, the sick boy has a sister.
In like the original Kamen Rider manga. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
romanticized, isn't it? Like, I think she blushes or something.
She's into Hayato, and the little kid knows
and
it.
And Hayato's kind of embarrassed, but kind of likes it.
Yeah, if Ishinomori puts in, you know, it's fair game, right, for the entire franchise. So, yeah, love, why not?
Yeah, he certainly didn't, oh yeah, I mean, there's a couple I would have loved to see. Like, I'm really stuck on them.
What happened in Sweden? What happened?
I think it's a huge shame that Jumanji never got a lady friend.
I think it's a shame Tachibana.
He's got...
One character I wanted to see get a love episode is Tachibana. Now, I've only seen half of the original Rider series, and I know it probably never happened, but my goodness, I wanted to see something happen there.
I would way more be into Tackle and Tachibana than Tackle and Stronger.
Wow, age difference.
Wow.
Yeah, go for it.
I don't know if that would get past the...
Because he's quite suave.
He's a cool
guy.
For,
like, a grown man, and he's got a whole motorcycle company, and he's got some cars, and he knows what's up. He combs his hair nicely. He can smoke with aplomb.
Get it,
Tackle.
But that's never tackled. She's, you know, she's the one Rider girl at the time. That's not fair. I think I wanted to see like a new lady. I just wanted to see one episode, like some sad Ghost in the Shell one episode where the nice old guy has kind of a, you know, he has feelings for somebody and a nice older lady. Maybe they've both been through a lot.
No, because he would have to have his heart broken.
Well, yeah.
I don't want that.
Okay.
I've had enough old men who are so nice in the protagonist role getting their heart broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
There's an episode of Ironside. Don't even ask me about that.
Is there an episode of Ironside where he falls in love?
Yeah.
Ironside
she's
can't
got
fall
amnesia.
In love. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, at least he'll always have Mark. Okay, so, hey, love gets a thumbs up from all of us.
Okay.
Lead us on, leader.
Yeah, I guess I will. Alright, so, I guess... I don't know. I'm kind of disappointed that I didn't go back over my notes as much as I would have liked to, but, you know, it is unchangeable. So, we'll just move forward. So, Atoya's legacy is something I thought really came to the foreground in this stretch of episodes, particularly through 15 through 18. Let's see, his lessons, his lesson to Mommy and me.
Is that how we're saying it? Sorry, I know it's kind of a sidetrack, but I would pronounce it Mammy. I guess they're both kind
Mammy?
Of silly.
Yeah, yeah, they both have
Mammy.
Yeah, they don't sound good.
No, anyway.
Can we just call her old lady?
Oh,
sure. What is it? Oba?
Oba-chan.
Yeah, so
yeah,
mean.
I thought that was really funny that Megumi was calling her old. I kind of alluded to this earlier, that the breaking the chain thing is really impacting me. There's a concept, it's a Yiddish term, but it's a concept from Judaism called shtegging, or to shteg. And I will explain what that means. It's basically like always moving forward. It literally means path, and it means that you're always moving forward, incrementally improving upon yourself and making strides to be a better person and to, I don't know, be more productive. So, like, that combined with break the chain and in my mind, and it's really spurred me on to, like, do things and change myself, improve myself even more. Just, like, I don't know if it's, like, the force or the almost like the violence behind the concept of breaking the chain, I think kind of acted as a catalyst for me to say, like, yeah, this is something I really want to do. I do want to break the chain. I'm sick of being tied to certain things.
Yeah.
And like at the same time, I'm grounded by my morals and by my faith. But at the same time, I feel emboldened to transcend all unnecessary fetters and kick down any doors. And now I'm referencing the song. but like, it's how I feel, and it's good. And I think it's like a great message for kids to be seeing, and
yeah.
Like Watru kind of gets some of the message, but like, of course, he doesn't know it's from his father, and I think it really has an effect on him, and I don't know, I like it.
I think it's
cool.
One of the best things about Kiba that it has this, I mean, every writer's series probably, if you think about it long enough, has a core concept like that, a moral, but I think Kiba does a good job of actually putting it across. You know, a lot of series will talk the talk, but Kiba actually shows the characters breaking their bad habits.
Are we talking about Gaim again?
No, of course not. Of course we're not talking about Gaim. No, I mean, like I said before, you know, you can talk about, you can have a scene, a dream sequence talking about philosophy all you want, but when the action scene comes, you have to bear that philosophy out.
We're talking about Gaim again.
And I think Kiba does that, and that's good, and let's move on. Because this is a podcast about Kiba.
Yeah.
And not Orange Machine Gun series.
Okay. Alright. I guess I'll go forward. So, I kind of don't want to say this because I don't want to rehash and retread things, but I'm saying it anyway. It seems that Toya laid the foundation for Watru to be Kiva with the three monsters. And I'm just referring to them in shorthand.
They're called the Arms Monsters, for what it's worth.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Arms Monsters, there you go. I'm sure we'll find that out in 5 episodes.
No.
right?
No, okay. Never. It's like, it's in like, you know, the books or whatever.
The source book, okay.
Yeah.
Yes, whatever, it's okay.
Toys and stuff.
So, like, I want to know, was he Kiva in the past? Because somebody makes reference to a past Kiva and how there was a Kiva before.
You don't want to know.
And... No, I don't. Of course I don't. I need to know. That's why I want to keep watching the show. And then, like, Ixa's fossils.
Fossils.
Yeah, you like that?
It's better than the real name. Yeah.
What are they really called?
Fake fossils. That's it.
Are you kidding me? Yeah. What the? All right.
Fake. That's it.
Yeah, I think their existence supports the idea that there was a Kiva somewhere before him. I mean, and it's specific, it's explicitly referenced somewhere.
Yeah.
But we just don't know who it
no,
was.
No, it is, because so. When Otoya possesses Wataru, he recognizes Kibat-Bat the Third, and
right.
Kibat-Bat the Third mentions his dad, presumably Kibat-Bat the Second, who was presumably bonded to the previous Kibat. And
we can assume his father was Kibat-Bat the First, right?
But yeah, and in fact, it's not
why
a spoiler.
Called Henry?
The episode that introduces the Queen, Maya, I don't know if her name's actually been given, but her name's Maya. When she's introduced at the very end of the episode, you see a silhouette of her walking off with a little bat shape fluttering around her, and I think it's pretty obvious who that is. So it's all set up. You're going to find out who the previous Kiva was, is, could be.
Oh my goodness.
I just wanted to get that reaction.
Oh, this show is so damn compelling. I love it. Whew, okay, sorry.
Really simply, great thing, isn't it? That they set up all this backstory, this sort of history and mythology, which I know a lot of people love, and I think it's something that I really like, because I was interested in mythology as a kid. I love it when you have a solid history for something, just a bunch of made-up stuff, but it's like a solid history that makes sense and has traditions and rules. Again, that's why I love the Fanguys so much, and...
But it's the way it's brought in as well, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's not like, now sit down, audience, and I should explain to you
the rules.
The
exposition is perfect.
It's referred to as if everyone involved already knows, which is very important.
The introduction...
That's why I love Dune so much. I probably said that before, but that was like a really... That was the first time I realised that was something that you could do with writing. You could create a mythology and refer to it as if it's normal, and that makes it better.
Well, that's why I love fiction, good fiction in general, because good fiction will do that, regardless of the medium. Be it a film, a novel, or whatever, will bring you into that world and make you look forward and not... It's an odd feeling. You know that it's going to be explained, but you're still desperate for it to be explained.
And you sort of... You keep yourself open to learning. You ready yourself to take it in, instead of feeling like you have to scrabble to catch up.
Yeah, well, some series that we might have discussed, they prompt a lot of speculation, and they prompt a lot of confusion, and I don't think that's good. I actually think that that's a mark of a poorly written story. Whereas with Kiva, I don't know, because I actually kind of wasn't really into Kamen Rider that much when Kiva was on. Because I'd seen Kabuto and loved it, and then Dano did nothing for me immediately. I've since learned my lesson. But yeah, I wasn't paying attention, so I don't know what people said about Kiva at the time.
Yeah, I don't know. All I have to say, I know I said this a little bit before, but the pacing is so good. Like, I didn't care to know about these mysteries or whatever you want to call them. I haven't been burning for them, so to speak.
Yeah.
They kind of are organically introduced subtly, and then, I wonder what's going on with that. And then fairly soon, you get a resolution or at least some answers to it and some light shed on the subject. And then it just slowly, like every 4 or 5 episodes, you'll learn a little something more about different characters and different things in the world. And it's just all slowly rolled out. And it's woven like this really wonderful tapestry. And I don't know. I don't know.
Well, no, it's a great example of it is like something like Checkmate 4, where that you hear that phrase and you think, well, I know there's going to be 4 of them. And you're just patiently waiting, and we've had Rook and Queen introduced, and you're like, well, I'm just waiting for the rest now. But you're not going nuts over it, you know. Unless you're me and you think, well, hang on, because there's more than 4 chess pieces. Anyway.
I feel like I can trust Kiva.
Sure, that's nice. That's a nice feeling.
Yeah, it is a nice feeling. I feel like I can trust it to reveal things at a regular and satisfying pace.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I felt the first time. I mean, I know, obviously, but that's how I feel.
No, and, like, I have 2 more questions. It's like, when and how did the Blue Sky Party make the fossils? Because,
stay tuned.
Yuri's... I know, that's the thing. I don't even want to ask them. I didn't want to bring them up, But except for to bolster your point that, yeah, I know the show. I know the show's going to answer these questions. And it'll just be a matter of time. Maybe it'll be 5 episodes. Maybe it'll be 10. But I feel like very soon I'm going to be getting answers to these things. And if not, other things will have been introduced that I'll have answers to. And it'll all just kind of, I'll be satisfied broadly. I'll be so satisfied broadly with the show that the things that are still there unanswered aren't frustrating.
I think you can reconcile a lot for it yourself. You already have with Ixa. You already think, well, it's obviously based on the Kiva system. So, like, you know, then you don't need to be told that. And that's what's cool about
right.
it. You can see just from the way he henshins and, you know, the fact that it has a belt with whistles that you just know. It's great.
right. Okay, let's see. Oh, Otoya and Jiro team up for Yuri. I thought this was so cool. I hope to see more of this. Jiro starts to win me over here. I actually want to see these guys become friends, like I said earlier, regardless of who Yuri loves.
There's something that... Okay. Stop shaking your head at me. We've warned you that there's
I was just gonna say something,
a bad pair of episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And they aren't coming out
yes.
next. But after that, it does rise again. And I think there's some stuff that you will really enjoy regarding what you've just said. And
okay, and...
yeah, it's quite
something. I kind of thought that maybe they were episodes 19 and 20.
No.
And that maybe you were confused, so it gets worse than that.
Oh, yeah.
It really takes
I thought that...
a dive. What, which one 19
your...
and 20?
The one where the women can't, like, use Ixa because they're women?
Or, no, see, that,
I mean, that's never said explicitly, but
that
it feels like it to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
it does feel like it to you, and it will feel like it to the children, even though they don't realize.
Yeah.
That is not so much, I think, bad. Well, see, we haven't got to the bit that we, the notes on that, but... That was in character for everyone involved.
Keep coming back to that. We did that with Otoya as well. Just
yeah.
It's in character. It feels
it,
okay.
It didn't not make sense with events that had been happening, and it did serve as growth for the characters involved. It doesn't. It's not out of sync with the rest of the series. The stuff that we're talking about, really, it just...
It's a bitter pill to swallow, though, isn't it, still?
It is, yeah.
You just...
Yeah, it surely is.
Bittersweet, I guess.
But, yeah. It wasn't those.
Yeah, and, like, it's...
No, what is it?
It's
20,
so 20? Frustrating.
Go on, sorry.
Okay. It's so frustrating because, like, I love Watoya. like, that's so cool, but he is instrumental in not only telling Yuri that she can't be Ixa because... She's too emotional or whatever, and Megumi as well, and like when he throws Ixa in the fire and the Ixa knuckle or whatever, and then she gets up and runs and knocks it over. Like, one, I didn't know how she was going to fix it, and the way she was able to rise above the obstacle of it being in the fire, like, I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have like tried to reach my hand in there and probably gotten burned like an idiot, but like, she does it smartly.
And it is
like
a shame.
Like,
there's no payoff.
She should
that,
be capable. Although. The show shows us right there she is capable of being Ixa, but then no, she isn't because she's too emotional, or I can't even remember. The resolution or the reason given was so upsetting and so frustrating that I can't even remember it now.
Ixa shouldn't be used for personal gain. That is the general justification they come back to.
I don't.
Okay, that's. Go ahead. Sorry. Go.
No, it is.
I don't mind it. In itself, I just think it's really poorly placed within the series and within the franchise and within the demographics of the show otherwise.
It's a shame.
I think that, and even like having both of them being shown at the same time to both fail, I mean, they are the only two female characters who are actually involved in the plot, and showing them to both fail due to personal fear, which none of the male characters really fall to. Yuri's fear is mortal. Megumi's fear is selfish, essentially, that she's not good enough, that she can't live up to her family's whatever. It's not the same as Washiru not wanting to become Kiba because he might have to murder people. It's not the same as, well, it's not the same as any of the other reasons why people have shied away from transformations. Like, it doesn't really, really hurt. Because I think by the time Yuri gets the chance, or it's not really coming up that it hurts you anymore, is it?
I think they probably sweep that under the rug. Yeah. I'm honestly right. You said it there. It's a lot because of the... there's a lot of stuff that could be easily changed that would suddenly make it okay. And I don't know if I'm doing this in my head because I don't like to hypothesize too much, if I'm just blowing smoke, but the idea of not using it for personal gain, that appeals to me, especially with regards to Nago, and it's a shame that it has to come at the cost of the representation of the prominent two female characters, because actually, that's a brilliant idea of, you know, Nago is so, I don't know what it is about him, but something about that appeals to me, that Shima even thinks that he would be selfish. Shima himself would be selfish to use Ixa. So he chooses this psychopath to use it. I don't know...
Gandalf never thought of that.
I don't know what there is in that, and I don't get that reference, but I know there's something there, and it's a shame that I don't recall that comes out. I don't recall that comes to fruition. I like that angle, though.
Mm. I don't think that not getting Ixa in those episodes does a disservice to Megumi or Yuri as characters or as people. I do think it does a disservice to other people's perceptions of them and to, you know, the cause of women in things.
Yeah, to the story universe.
Because they do both have genuine reactions to it. They both live through the experience and dislike it and deal with it. And they become greater from not being able to have it.
It's more than what happens to Mary and Fize, isn't it, in that first episode?
Oh, God,
It's very different.
Because that's just, you can't do it. You're rubbish. So she's like, okay, someone else can do it, a boy.
But I think I still see where Pez is coming from, that, like, that's still not good enough.
No, it's not good enough. See, it's hard to know who to talk about because I don't know if there was... Like, I would not be shocked if there was some decree that thou shalt not make a girl a writer in a series at the time.
Sure.
I don't know if I can say Inoue didn't want to. Like, he might not have wanted to. He might have intended all along to not allow them to actualize his Ixa because he doesn't write perfectly untainted of sexism female characters. He just does write strong female characters, well written and well rounded.
But maybe it is his weird way of like getting them. What if it is?
Well, yeah,
what
it is. It is very much a re-kitchening.
Getting them as close.
But
I'd never heard that term before.
Can I bring up Gaim real fast?
Yes.
No,
that reminds
okay.
me very much. No, I'm doing it. Okay. Sorry, I'm pulling rein.
Tell her the bus.
I got to be honest.
Okay.
I was like, well, I feel very pumped up today because I was like taking care of business earlier
nice.
To prep for this time, and like I did so awesomely that like I'm high on it. I may have to go like break some boards in half or something.
Fire the laser.
After this. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've had the meatloaf
anyway.
On, so I know how you feel.
So. That reminds me exactly of what we determined might be what Urobuchi was doing with Mai.
Mm.
Because she doesn't want to be a writer because it's stupid and she wants to dance and all these boys are ruining her thing by armored riding instead of being beat riders.
Yeah.
Which is the author, the writer, whoever, determining that this person who can be and who should probably be, because they're so strong, a human being, a writer, is not going to be because they refuse to, because it's below them or it isn't the sort of thing they would want to do, even though they'd be fully capable of doing it and would be awesome at it, I bet.
Tackle the head of the writer registration department all along.
Yeah.
Worst joke ever.
Ever. There's... I think there's a distinction to be made in positive female representation options. Because there's the boundary smasher, and then there is characters that show you how to be the best you can, within the constraints of a patriarchy. Mm. And that's not to say that those depictions necessarily say that it's good that we're in a patriarchy, but they don't necessarily say it's bad either. They just say, look, we have to deal with it, so let's do that and also be great.
Which honestly is something coming from a male writer. That's quite an achievement, to even acknowledge that they're in a situation that doesn't favour them.
Like, that's a big thing in gothic novels, female gothic novels especially, and there's a lot of discussion and disagreement over whether it's positive or whether it's regressive, because, it's really hard to say, and maybe there is no ultimate answer, but it's complex. But the woman who, like, in the female gothic novel, the accepted tropes of this title are, like, the girl goes somewhere where she's not really got much authority, and there's something that seems supernaturally alarming, and she deals with it through through remaining herself and dealing with it through whatever means she can, and then it turns out that it's not really actually supernatural at all, and basically the whole thing comes to learning how to navigate a world that for being female. Like, often it's a bodily thing as well. Like, it's about women learning to deal with the inherent weakness of their state as a female, and whether that's weakness put on you by the state or social conventions or through, like, biological whatever. Like, some people believe that it's determined that you're weaker if you're a lady, which obviously is just trash, but in fiction that will sometimes be a concern. And I think this is, like, there's a lot of this in Kiva, and there's a lot of it in these two episodes specifically, because Yuri does not live, she lives in Japan in the 80s, and that is not a feminist wonderland. And so it's almost like lying if she just gets it with no problems and then it's fine. So showing her having to battle through failing at beating sexism, some people would be able to find more strength in that than if she actually got to be Ixer immediately.
Yeah.
Ideally we would have both, obviously. Like, I'm not saying it's not necessary to give any female character the lead role or the action role or the henshin role, but these are valid female narratives, and it's just a real shame that they exist in a world that is so sexist and in a storyline that has so much misogyny floating around, because it means they don't really stand out and they just sort of stick to all of the crap and float to the bottom and end up looking really bad, when actually there's a lot in them that is really quite good.
And I think the frustration that Ez is feeling here is very valid, and I think it maybe shows him what a small fraction, you know, of what that's like, rather than making you angry about where the story is going, it should make you care about the representation of women in fiction, I think. So, you know, if this makes us care more about that, I'm all for it. I'm not nearly as annoyed at the fact that Megumi and Yuri don't become Ixa as I am at the fact that no women get to do anything in Kamen Rider. That's it.
Yeah, like Megumi overcoming her, what's the word for it? Psychosomatic injury.
Mm.
That is
her like pseudo illness.
Yeah, that's like a direct retelling, a new version of you are a woman, so you will be weaker. You have the weight of this expectation on you, and you also have the weight of the expectation. Like, her mother died, and before she was able to be Ixa, Like, her mother wanted to be Ixa, and she wasn't able to, and that was to do with being a woman. So it's, like, psychological female weakness. She knows that she's devalued by others on that level, and that will reflect on how you feel about yourself, because you can't help but know what people think about you and wonder if it's true. It's pretty good, really.
It's one of the best case studies for the issue,
yeah.
I think. In this genre, in this franchise, whatever.
Yeah, I think you brought up all really good, valid points, and it's interesting to see and to think about the concept that you've mentioned before about, well, the strong female character isn't, you know, just able to, you know, punch monsters or whatever. There's more to that. There's, you know, her being an actual person and a woman, and all the things that that means in a story. And I think that's really important to remember. And it's just, I'm just, my notes and my frustration are based just on the raw emotion of it. But upon further thought, you're right, there is a lot of value, to see out of that. And, just the, I guess the impetus to not let that stand anymore is a good thing, even though I don't necessarily like what had to transpire or be shown, because it's really, it's the truth. It's in the past, it's happened, it is happening now, and avoiding that in the fiction doesn't help anything.
The emotion is good, though. Like, the emotion is important, too, because it is coming from, it's not made up. Like, even if it is not necessarily as ultimately bad for women as you initially felt, like, you have these emotions because there is a problem. It just may not be the one you initially identified as, like, the exact cause.
It takes a lot of guts to accept the problems and write about those and then show them being overcome, rather than just sort of ignoring them, you know. Strong female characters with capital letters, you know? Lara Croft.
Yeah.
You know, you can ignore the issue and pretend that your character is very powerful and has a lot of agency in their story, but that doesn't take a lot of courage.
I'm really glad that you are annoyed that they don't get to be Ixa, though, and that they and that they fail to fear or whatever, because it means that I don't have to be doing that. I don't have to cover that angle. Like,
oh.
As the girl here.
I was, like, gritting my teeth. Sorry, I was gritting my teeth and forcing myself to not interrupt you and let you say what cogent thoughts you had, just so that I wouldn't be, like, frothing and growling because of how frustrating it is. And, like, I don't know. I've made mention before of stuff that I'd like to share with my, well, I guess both of them now, my children. And, like, this was quickly becoming, like, oh, I've got to show them Black. I've got to show them Kiva. And, like, this hurts to know that I'm going to be showing this to them, especially if they think it's cool, because, like, they might see, like, oh, look at that, you know, she's a girl and she's fighting and, you know, beating up monsters and stuff, and, like, that aspect will be lost, but hopefully the things, like, her turning down the marriage proposal because she needs to be her own woman for some time, which, like, you can debate. Some of that's a little bit debatable, but I see where they're coming from, and I was happy with that choice at this point in the show, and I think there's just things she needs to take care of on her own before she ties herself to someone, and I'm saying that as a neutral statement, not pejoratively. So, like, that is a courageous and strong step, because she kind of has a sure thing if she goes with Jiro, and has him be her, you know, husband or whatever. Like, I don't know. We can get more into that later, because we do talk about that later in these notes, or I do address that. But I think that was a strong choice, and it doesn't. While it doesn't redeem what happened and my frustrations, it certainly textures her character and makes the whole situation more interesting.
Also, one of the best developments, I think, between Yuri and Otoya is when she lets herself cry on him.
Yeah.
That's, like, that's hella strong. That's your strong female character. Like, she's being vulnerable, and she knows that she doesn't necessarily have a guarantee that he won't be a dork about it.
I think I said in the last episode, right, part of your strength is about the amount of range of emotions the actress is allowed to do. Like, it's as simple as that. If you have female characters doing different things, becoming real, all-rounded human beings. That's strength.
Yeah.
They don't have to shoot guns. They just have to do different stuff.
That's a really strong scene for Atoya as well, though, because he doesn't push it.
No.
For once.
But then, yeah, he's just there for her.
Yeah, and I like that relationship between them. I like them meeting as equals, and it's more grown up.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's kind of the adult segment of the show. That's what's cool about it.
Yeah, it's a relief to see. I mean, even no matter what happens, and we know that he wants to date her and whatever, but it's not presented as a romantic thing then. And seeing a man and a woman be friends is, you know, good. That's good.
Yeah. It's rare, and it's good.
Yeah, I don't know. Never mind. Okay. Skip it. I'm going to move on. We've said a lot. This is really rich.
The next two episodes will give us plenty to talk about on this subject.
Oh.
Great, we might.
For good or ill. So just look forward. Okay?
Oh, no. No, never mind. I was going to say, he better not eat Yuri, but she has to have Megumi first. I was going to, like, that
well,
son of a...
Well, you know,
anyway.
TV Nihon
oh, according to
notes
TV Nihon,
come down,
yeah.
And that can mean something else.
Eat.
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's come afterwards.
Never mind.
You know that.
Yeah.
I was going to say something very embarrassing. Let's move on.
Yes. We don't want to be embarrassed.
Sorry, I'm blushing. oh my goodness. Well.
Hey.
Giggle segment.
Good job. Yes. We're going to talk about the funniest character in the show now.
Yay.
Yeah, exactly. So, in these episodes, we get to see Nago's descent into madness.
Yes.
He really is the worst.
Yeah.
And is madly fixated on the button collecting, like a serial killer. Like, he really, really is like a serial killer.
Yeah.
There is scene where he just says the word button, isn't there? He doesn't say anything, he just goes...
Multiple times, right?
So good.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. Like, he makes such an ass out of himself. And I hope this is, like, the transforming... Or the purifying fires, and he'll be refined after this somehow. Or maybe there needs to be like one more step to bring him down to the absolute bottom, and then he'll be better, or be able to be at the ground floor and get better from there. But he's like Atoya, the spider finger, for obsessing on Kiva and buttons, as opposed to the ladies, the Asoi ladies. He's awful, and I have nothing to say about
but
him.
But isn't it satisfying to see him fall?
Yeah, I love that he's this... Like, he's becoming this really pathetic loser.
Yes!
And
isn't
I
that
love
wonderful?
To see that. It is. If only they had done that with, what's-his-face. Like you guys had said earlier.
What's-his-face?
Yeah, you know. That punk. Shotaro. Do I have to say his name?
Oh, him.
He who shall not be named.
So many characters.
I thought you were saying that about Tendo, or I was ready to stick my fist through the internet.
Oh, no, like, you mentioned the literal Shotaro getting arrested. Yeah, that would have been great. Yeah, same as I want to happen to Kaito. Well, actually, I want everyone in Gun to be arrested. That's not about it.
Yeah.
Hey, Kota, you've actually committed manslaughter.
Shh, it's not about Gun.
Maybe address that.
It's not about Gun.
Brilliant show.
All right. And everybody just loves it. Man, I can't wait. Anyway.
Nago, not only is he losing his grip on himself, he's also losing his grip on his presentation of himself. in fact, you know what?
What?
Like in Gaim. Why
are you doing this?
I didn't want to catch up, but someone...
Yeah. No, well, I said I wasn't going to talk about it anymore, but I still had to, I don't know, I had to keep giving it the odd chance. And...
So I, saw bits, but Nago, like Mitch, has just shown his hand before he meant to, and honestly, I think before he should have, in Mitch's case.
Yeah. Oh, no, well, that's, yeah.
Looking down and whispering, why don't you just shut up and do what I tell you?
Yeah, it's too much.
We know. But for Nago,
we
know, and now you're not even managing to hide it, and that is a relief, because
There's a lot more pleasure.
Well, it's like the sick joy people get in following the downfall of politicians who do the thing they were legislating against.
Yeah.
Like, the hypocrisy is just there to see, and that's very cathartic, because if you don't even have to work to make the person show their true colours, then it's just waiting.
It's the purest Schadenfreude, where you don't even have to. You're inactive. You're a completely passive audience.
It validates what you knew.
It's like fast food.
And what was being denied.
Yeah.
And that is very. It's a peaceful feeling.
Fast food comeuppance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just desserts. Just as healthy, unhealthy as dessert can be.
But by the dating party, it's just. You know, fun.
Well, the dating party fixes everything. Yeah, this is kind of the start of his, like, sort of face turn.
Yeah.
And it's triggered almost entirely by Kengo, in my opinion. But I'll probably get that onto that more later.
Alrighty. I don't know why I'm talking about Kivat's independence before. Maybe because I didn't talk about it enough last time. He's definitely butler and guardian to some extent. But he is his own person, and it's really cool. When and how did they meet? I'd like to see that, and I'm sure we will soon. And I like how he, when Watcher is doubting himself, he says, "Remember, boy! Like, we've been over this, so you know why you have, like why I'm around and why you have these Kiva powers, and you have to remember what your reason is for being Kiva." Like, kind of almost to me, like, he's saying, like, you're kind of privileged to have the power of Kiva, and, like, you need to remember that that's your responsibility to use that, or else, I don't know, it's a waste, or you're being a bad person.
I think Kiva's probably one of my favorite Zordons.
Yeah. No, he's really great. He's really great. But questions. Is he alive? He better be. Well, he is a father, or whatever, a progenitor, so there's something to that. And then he was sick, but what made him sick?
Yeah,
I gotta know. I feel bad for the guy.
There's no reason for it.
I don't think it's ever...
It's just wonderful realism.
Well, wasn't it to excuse Wataru losing a plot-relevant fight or something? I don't even
know. Yeah, something like that.
But yeah, he just had a cold. As to whether he's alive or not, I mean, that depends on your definitions.
Not
like,
dead.
What do you mean? Yeah, he's. I don't really know what he is. I don't know what he's made of. He looks metal, doesn't he? Or at least like that's what they were getting at with the CG.
Yeah, something like that.
Because he's very solid and he makes clicky noises when his wings flap. So. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, he's got a dad, so.
Yeah. I was.
We never find out if he has a mother.
Well, of course we don't.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, which might lead someone to believe that they are sort of machines, and basically, you know, it's a symbolic dad. He's just his predecessor.
Maybe if a Kivat bites a hockey puck, then...
then another Kivat is spawned. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I was actually, like, I really like him a lot. Like, I was telling my wife the other day that, first of all, I like blasted Kiva love at her for like 20 minutes, and then I told her that I really want to get a little Kivat and sit him on my desk and, you know, have him bite me every now and then.
It's an interesting point, actually, that you said, I don't know why I brought this up now, but no, it's Kivat as a mentor is really cool, because he gets to be equal parts goofy and authoritative, I think, which is kind of rare.
Yeah, you don't see Zordon, like, getting...
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Probably.
Maybe you do. I've not seen enough Power Rangers to know.
But my childhood memory suggests that you probably would not.
My what little I know of Zordon is that he probably never, like, says, "Cowabunga, dude, I made a funny," or whatever, with a lampshade on his head. I don't know.
But Kivat can...
He can do everything.
Can tease Washeru about girls and get a bucket thrown over him.
Yeah, and he washes his hair, but he also lectures him about his responsibility. And when Wataru is being a wimp, Kivat will go and fight by himself.
Yeah, that's cool.
And he's boastful in a fight as well. Like, he boasts about his speed one time, you know? And he's so knowledgeable about art. He loves art history and cultural history. There's a lot to him for a mentor character, I think. Usually the most you expect is...
He's very rich.
Wise, and perhaps... wacky, eccentric, kind of drunken master sort of thing.
And not only for a character, or like a mentor character, but a toy mentor character. Like, he really is... I mean, I just said I wanted to buy him. Like, you know, we have a Yoda plushie at home, and apparently he's my son-in-law. I don't know how that happened, but it did. but, like, you know, these little mentor characters can be adorable and cute, and we love them and want to have them around us.
Yeah, so. As merchandise goes, he's pretty amazing. I think, you know, if it was a choice between having him and, like, a belt shaped like a W on my mantelpiece, I'd probably have the cute bat. Because yeah. He's got a character, right? And that's great. That's a great point that I hadn't even thought of, that even the Henshin device has character. Real character.
And a proper aesthetic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he looks great, doesn't he?
Like, he is a thing, a person, not a design or a decorated thing.
No, but he looks cool.
Yeah.
And, I love the way his mouth moves and how it goes with his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get the impression he's maybe older, but his age is kind of hard to place. Like, his human age is kind of hard to place. But like I said, he's kind of a butler. I don't know why I see him that way.
Yeah, but he's pretty awesome. Okay, so we were talking about Watcher's identity crisis, and I thought that was pretty cool. And that's kind of, it hinges upon, I think in 15 and 16 maybe, the Dai/Rook incident, and like how bad that was.
Sad.
Yeah,
really sad.
If Overtime subbed Kiba, would they call Dai-chan Biggie?
Probably.
I'm sorry. all right. Okay. Here's a good question. Maybe I don't know if this is the kind of thing people notice. What was your first reaction, like, if you had one, to the Lion Fang guy's design? Because it's pretty crazy, right?
It is crazy.
Yeah, okay,
I thought it was. It definitely was. It's aesthetically in a different league from the other Frangire. Actually, he has white on him, and all of them are just black. I didn't even think about that until now, but he's got a lot of white, right?
Yeah.
And it says Rook on his biceps, I think.
Yeah, he's got little towers, little Rook towers for shoulders, and trumpets with flags on.
Yeah.
It's insane. And what I love about it is, you know that Rook is the weakest of the Checkmate 4 because he's introduced first. And it makes you wonder what the heck the rest of them look like.
Yeah.
For me, at least.
Yeah, it actually makes... inspires some interest. Mm. And
he looks so strong, and he's put over so strong. He seems like a genuinely unstoppable force. Mm. And a lion is such a, normal, tough animal, isn't it? And it immediately puts me in mind of, for instance, the lion, I think it's the Leo Imagine in Deno, which is, I think, one of the most boring designs in Deno. And he's one of the top guys, and I think it's funny how you can take something as cliched as a lion and do something new with it. And I think that Rook's design really succeeds that way, as does the Leo Zodiacs. I love that design. I love that head design. So that's daring. I think Rook is scary and original, and again daring, like trumpets.
Yeah.
Someone had to push for that in a meeting, didn't they?
Probably, yeah.
No, we're not putting trumpets on him, come on.
And again, he's a tough, masculine guy who's also totally precious.
Yes!
With his ice creams, and he just wants to find something fun, and he plays his little games like he's a baby.
Oh, yeah, and isn't that a great, Japanese, I was going to say, an anime serial killer gimmick, I've got a timed game to play and I have all these arbitrary rules. He definitely seems a level above the other Fangires right from the start, doesn't he?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad for the rules that he has, or that in a way provided, because it spares Yuri, because she would have been dead otherwise. if not for some other plot contrivance. It's interesting. It was here's the thing. It was really suspenseful because I didn't know what was going to happen to her. If someone was going to come save her, if she was going to fight him off herself or escape or some. And then the clock runs down, and it beeps. His little Casio or whatever he has. And I was really glad. It was just so relieving. It was really effective. And I was glad to see that.
Does he get a better watch in 2008? I didn't even notice that. I hope he does.
I don't even think he has a watch.
Because he's Dai-chan.
He's Dai, and then he inexplicably gets his memories back. I don't even remember what sparked it, but all of a sudden he starts remembering, and then there you go.
It gets triggered by the environment, I think, doesn't it?
Maybe.
because he remembers something, yeah, and he goes there and it brings it all back.
It's just like actual, you know, purported cures for amnesia. He just sees something that he remembers from his past. So.
And I am so excited to see what happened to him in the past that made him lose his memory. Yeah. And, like, once again, I know we keep saying this, but there is a solid... There has to be a bridge between the 80s and the 2000s, because the writing is consistent, and we know that there's some point... You know, he's at point C now, and there was a point A that we saw him at, so where's B? Or,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe it's A to Z, and there's all this stuff in the middle that we can see. And I'm really excited to see that, and yeah.
Isn't it competent, though, how characters appear and complete a small arc and then come back later? And you are pleased to see them, because they're not surplus to requirements. They do have more things to give. But you don't feel like they've been cut off in the middle of their story. Mm. Like, I'm not thinking... When I'm watching... the episodes after this, I'm not thinking, well, where's Rook gone? Why aren't we still seeing Rook?
Kind of...
And when Kengo leaves, like, you expect him not to come back, because he'd completed his first mission, essentially, as a character in the Game of story.
Well, Rook, in particular...
But it's really well reincorporated and really well set aside for later.
Yeah, well, Rook in particular has done well as a baddie, because you effectively trade him for Queen.
Mm.
She basically comes along, says... get out, he does, then we have a bit of time with Maya, you know. So I think trading between the top-level bad guys like that, I think that's quite a clever way of getting around, you know, the clichés of this genre, of the monster of the week genre. Get a little bit political, you know, have it actually mean something when you swap one baddie for another, rather than just having an episode called Peach Rider Descent. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay, so my notes about Dai are basically kind of linked to Watru's identity crisis, which I don't think I explicitly pointed out earlier, but he does question why he's fighting, and I referenced it earlier, so hopefully that all ties together. And it's really cool that he has this identity crisis, and he wonders why he's doing what he's doing and wants to stop because it's, you know, his gift, it's his curse, and all the people he loves or enjoys the company of get hurt because of him being Kiva or whatever, but it's interesting.
Well, he said, can I just cut for a second?
Go ahead.
Because he does actually say, everyone I think is a nice person turns out to be a fangire.
Yeah.
Which isn't just everyone who I think is a nice person turns out to be someone I have to fight. It's much more innate than that.
Yeah. It's much more innate.
I wonder if that means, if, like, he's over-exaggerating, or if that means something, and there is a truth to it, like, he's drawn to the Fangire, or they're drawn to him, and what that could mean for, or, you know, in series, because that could be an important thing.
Could be.
And I'd like to see that fleshed out,
I'm saying,
because it really is interesting. Like, even his, not his girlfriend, but, Mio, her name is Mio, I think she's a Fangire.
Why?
Because when Maya, right?
Yeah.
That's a queen.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know if it was the show or what, but there is something definitely very striking about her. And maybe it was just the way it was played up and Otoya's reaction to her, but I was like, whoa, that's the Fangire queen apparently, or whatever. She's interesting. Like, I'm sure there's going to be more from her, and I don't know, it was a very good entrance for that character, and I don't like entrances being a big deal. Like, I think it's dumb to say, like, oh, that's a really cool entrance, because people have to enter scenes. Like, it matters more what happens after,
and
the context.
And this guy was a wrestler in high school, isn't he? No, I know what you mean. I do hate, like, when they, you know, when they're first introduced, and they're able to crumble planets with a wave of their hand, and then 10 episodes later they just get their ass kicked. Yeah, that is annoying.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm pretty sure Maya grabs Mio, or sees her, and then says, this girl, and then she gets interrupted by something, or something.
No,
there's
wait,
something
the
like that.
The chameleon fan.
Oh,
guy.
The chameleon, that's right. Yeah, thank you.
The
chameleon, he wants to kill her, and then he says, this girl is ...
He does.
So I think she's a Fangire, and it's interesting because it's possible that Otoya is a human, and he and Queen or Maya get together and spawn Watru. Although, like, I can't see her being the kind mother unless she breaks away from the rules and doesn't want to follow the rules anymore and runs away from the Fengire Association and
breaks the chain.
Yeah, exactly. Which, like, it's really hard to imagine that, but at the same time, often, as you alluded to, Claire, people who make rules and campaign against things are often guilty of those same sins that they claim are so detestable.
It's probably hard to imagine Nago teaching us an exercise routine when you first see his debut, but he does.
In the show proper? In the show proper?
It's part of the Hyper Battle video, but it's totally in character by that point. Totally in character.
That's crazy.
When we get to the Hyper Battle video, whatever it's called, I think it's like Super Adventure video or something, we're going to do the exercise live on it.
But, I mean, now that I've said that, I don't think she would do that, but maybe she would, and you guys bring up the point of, you know, Nago's changing so much. The characters in this show really have changed, so it's possible that even though she's a villain, Maya will have a change where she goes and becomes this good woman. And, like, are both of his parents dead? And if so, maybe she gets taken out for leaving.
I'd completely forgotten about Maya until she appeared. And
okay.
Yeah, like, I don't know what else to say apart from definitely keep an eye on her, because now that I remember, she is quite a fascinating character.
Especially
as top-level baddies go, she might be one of the best in the show.
Okay. Despite her she's the outright gothic aesthetic bothers me sometimes.
Really? And okay.
Yeah, sorry.
How do you mean?
Well, don't apologize. Well,
isn't she dressed like I'm a doll from Wizard?
She has
a gothic Lolita.
It's pretty cheapy. Like she's got like an elegant gothic thing.
I like the hood. Well, I like that she has a hood.
The idea of a hood.
The hood was cool. The hood was cool.
And shorts thing, because she wears it in such an atypical way. Possibly not in, it may not be as atypical in Japanese street fashion as it would be here, but in Western stuff, if a character is wearing hot pants, then they're probably shaking it around, physically as well, and Mayo's very still.
As, like,
probably.
Cheap, doofy clothes and Ryder goes, I think if we can accept the existence of Team Baron, can we not put with my...
Well, I can't.
No. Yeah, I have a problem with that, too. And maybe I just need to see her again or see more of her, because...
Yeah, you're right.
I don't have any particular fondness for her outfit, either. I think that she manages to wear it with grace. I think she wears it much more capably than Philip wears his outfit.
Yeah, wow. especially chubby stubble Philip, my favourite Philip.
But no, I don't think that she's dressed particularly well. I think they could have done something more.
Matt, have you actually watched any Cougar? Like, are you familiar with how the Grongi dress when they're disguised as humans?
Oh, yeah, okay. I think it's a joke. like, as cool as Cougar is, like, there's a guy who dresses as a clown.
Yeah. Well, hey, one word, 1999. You know, it probably looked awesome at the time.
I guess.
Someone thought, okay, we're reinventing Kamen Rider from the ground up. It's going to be an ancient weapon, and the bad guys are all going to wear black lipstick, you know, and have chains and belts all over them.
Yeah, how did that slip past?
Yeah,
but you're probably right. In the fever of the late 90s, people were probably like, oh yeah, it's going to be so great, let's do it.
And hey, actually the worst thing about Maya for me, now that I just think about it, when is she going around wearing this thoroughly modern, crappy outfit? 80s. It's actually she's the least 80s looking character.
I mean, it was starting.
She's not. I wouldn't call that 80s goth by any. Her hair would be completely different, wouldn't it? I agree that she's. But again, isn't she introduced at a wedding, and she's meant to have that whole bridal thing going on with the veil she wears, the hood she wears, rather.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
It's all pretty simplistic symbolism at this stage.
Yeah, and actually, man, we're going all over the map, but it's okay. I think it's good. Like, I loved the idea of, you had brought up that there was the point that, somebody goes around, I'm assuming, well, here's the thing, Queen, she's the She's a really powerful figure. You said, like, she's an enforcer. But I think you said rook or bishop, actually, is the one who, like, keeps all the rules because he's a bishop and he has a book with him.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously biblical references or, like, references to the Catholic Church structure.
Sure.
But, like, she is executing punishment against this lady who's a Fengar who wants to, or who is in love with a human and wants to marry him. And I think, like, it's very fitting because she was there to lay punishment on this lady for wanting to marry. I don't know. I don't know what my point was, but maybe it works because of that. Who knows?
Well, you can decide for yourself about, you know, about Bishop soon enough.
Okay. That's... again, just like the way the show, like, slowly rolls everything out, it's deliberate, but so well, it's also well received.
Which well paced, by me. I think that's one of the valuable things.
Yeah. And I don't want to just keep saying that over and over again. Let's see. Should I go through my whole Yuri's Revenge thing?
Of course.
I'm not even sure. All right. Okay, so Yuri and this is from 19 to 22. Yuri and Jiro both wanting revenge on Rook makes me want them to be a couple. They now share such a bond that I want them to cope with the sorrow and hatred that won't be quenched by defeating Rook in each other's arms.
Right, like,
because
well, he seems too powerful, and I think they're just gonna have to like seek solace in each other. And I see nothing like depowering or bad about that at all. Well, I mean, you know, when you're defeated by the day, you can find solace in the embrace of. You know, your lover. Anyway,
yep, wood fire, nice rug.
Yeah, exactly.
Go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
I don't know.
It occurs.
You've got a rug.
Oh, well, sorry,
go on.
You could try.
It's not nice. It's me nan's.
Anyway, it occurs to me that they may be the reason he has amnesia. If that is the case, yeah, I am writing my own story here. I like the idea of them. Thinking they have a victory over him, but that being undermined by his survival, he neutralized that he may be, you know, lives on and terrorizes people in the future. And then here's some major speculation. Rook being taken out by Otoya's son seems terribly capital R romantic, especially if he targets Megumi at some point, which I don't think he did in the scope of these episodes. So,
I don't remember who takes Rook out. But, wow, my speculation ran wild for once the first time I saw all this, actually. I don't know if this is crazier than your theory. No, this is crazier than your theory. This is probably the craziest theory I've ever come up with. When we saw Rook being amnesiac, and at the same time, for some reason, I think they were talking about reincarnation, I got it in my head that, oh, well, maybe when a particularly powerful Fangar is killed in the 80s, they reincarnate with a blank slate, right? And at this time...
Only in the 80s?
Yeah, no. Y'all know what I mean. So, like, it got me thinking, because I didn't know whether or not Otoya was a Fangire. I thought, well, if he is, what if this possession thing that was going on at the time, what if Wataru is reincarnation, the amnesiac reincarnation of Otoya? Like, that is where I was thinking.
I hate that idea.
Now, well, that's the thing. I don't necessarily want to see it in the show, but that's like that was a genuine possibility to me at the time, which seems crazy now because it's not true. But I don't know. I kind of like the idea of these monsters being reincarnated and being able to make a fresh start, and because then that plays into the whole, you know, nurture or nature thing. Are they really evil? Do they really live just to kill people, or is it enforced on them by people like Bishop and Queen? Are they forced to live that lifestyle?
I'm really glad that that's not the case, though.
Why is that? Apart from, like, it's wrong.
I think it changes Wataru too much.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
I don't mind him inheriting the sins of Otoya through being his offspring, but I don't like him inheriting them through sort of technically having done them. I don't think that reincarnation has enough rules.
Oh, no, for sure. But yeah, that was just something that occurred to me at the time. It would be amazing if someone else thought the same thing as me, but like all of the pieces were in place, and it was really weird that they didn't go that way to me. But I thought, hey, in a way, they did a really good job of setting up something that never happened. Definitely.
Yeah, I might have like thought, what if that? But with Kiva, I was very much in command of my what ifs because I didn't want to entertain the possibilities that I didn't like.
Yeah, I usually am. Hey, you know.
Like at this, by this point, I was assuming about Yuri's.
Choice of husband?
Yes.
Oh, we were thinking. We were thinking all kinds.
Well, I was assuming.
Is Megumi a werewolf?
From the start, basically, I was assuming that the show was gonna make her go with Otoya. I didn't want that to happen at any point, so I was very determined in not looking at that option.
But you had is Megumi a werewolf, right? We totally thought that one.
Oh yeah, why not?
And then Kengo's introduction scenes. Are almost carefully interwoven with scenes of Jiro.
Yeah,
and
Jiro's return.
It makes you
not
wonder.
Return. I think he levels up to Ixodan, and so it's like a reintroduction of the character, like a reframing.
Exactly.
Kengo has the same interesting, attractive.
He's a rockin' rebellious guy. So why not?
Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. Okay, so we kind of talked about the Yuri and Megumi's fear and deficiency, all that stuff, but I have some solidified thoughts here. This is so disappointing, frustrating, and sad, especially because Professor Aso built it, the Ixa system. I can't believe her daughter and granddaughter can't use it. The only thing that would make it okay would be if she put a kill or inhibitor switch on it for them specifically, or anybody with her DNA, I guess, or like someone who's trying to be selfish with it. That would be interesting and make more sense, but that's dumb. But it isn't hateful though, so that's I guess a good thing. And why to Inoue in the suits? Like, why did you make this choice?
I think that would be worse because it isn't hateful. Like, it's a reason, but it's not a cruel one, so it makes it seem more okay. I think it's good that it's not. Legitimized by kind reasons. Like, it doesn't kneel down and say, I'm so sorry, that there's a reason that you can't do it. And also, I don't think the blame can go on one man alone.
Oh, no.
It's clearly an institutional thing.
It's more and more
sensible. Like, we know that producers have things to say about who can and can't be a Kamen Rider.
All this Honore Inoue stuff, it's Honore Television.
They're both good growth arcs, isolated from the greater Kamen Rider context, or from what they do amount to telling children that women fail because women fear. Mm. And so essentially, women are fearful failures, and that is a bad message. But, if you look at the stories outside of that knowledge, then they are good stories. It's all
fascinating
content.
To know what an actual kid, seeing it at the time, thought about these ladies. Mm. But I mean, that's. Oh.
Give me 5 years and I'll have a report for you.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not endemic to Inoue's work, and for what they are, Megumi and Yuri are way cooler than most of Ryder's leading ladies, such as they are.
Yeah, and I guess if there were the 11 legendary Riders and not Kivala, but you know what I'm saying, if Tackle was a Rider,
right.
By the company's standards or whatever, and there had been more like a better history in the franchise, I wouldn't be so upset.
Yeah.
But yeah, show by show, in this world, I can see it. Well, I know it's not too late, but it doesn't redeem this now.
No.
You know, in the future, it'll change things, God willing. But I don't know.
I think Yuri and Megumi probably helped. I think, you know, hey, we might not have Malika if it wasn't for Yuri. Is that a good thing? Yes, probably in the long run.
This is after Old Lady, isn't it?
Huh?
Yes, it is.
That's kind of strange. I think it would have felt better if that had come afterwards, because
for Megumi, you mean, like, for the character?
For everyone, for the
well, I would say for Yuri, for sure.
The overall feeling of
the overall feeling, because both of them get to interact with another woman.
Yeah.
Both of them get to protect and learn from her.
Yeah, and then...
And she's
sorry,
amazing.
Go ahead.
She's so cool. Who? Old lady.
Mammy. Yeah.
Mammy.
Mammy. Because she shoots a fangire.
Yeah.
With her bow.
Yeah, she does.
And
yeah, that was really
she's
awesome.
She's such a person. She's a female character who doesn't wear lipstick or high heels.
You get the benefit of seeing her at two very different ages.
Variety, yeah. She's basically, my feelings are summed up in the tiny moment where Jiro comes into the cafe, sits down. She comes out of the toilet, I think.
Hmm.
He looks at her, and there's like a howl in the background, and he just freezes creaks right round again to face the Bart, because he's acknowledging her as an incredibly strong-willed person. He's like, okay, I'm not messing with you. I don't even need to be involved in this.
That was a weird scene.
I'm not here dealing with you.
I'm not too sure I interpreted that, but yeah, that was a weird scene. Although,
no,
for all you love
I get it, though.
She can't put a tab on her hand.
No, she can't.
The archery was questionable.
Yeah, I don't know they had a consultant, because she was doing it wrong.
Yeah, and now that everybody in Kamen Rider has a bow and arrow, they better sort that stuff out.
Like, can I just explain what was wrong?
Please.
Please, please. And can you talk about the thing that goes on the chest of the archer? Because I don't understand that.
Yeah, I didn't use one of those.
Oh, the wuss guard. Yeah, no, Claire didn't have one of those.
It's not called a wuss guard. Male and female archers both can choose to wear them, but I think they tend to be recommended for females more, which is silly because they're not actually commonly necessary. They go on the one side to protect the side of you that is next to the string, because if the string catches on your clothing or... Like, if you're doing it really, really wrong, you might hurt your nipple.
Oh, no.
But if you're not doing it wrong... You won't. Only one person at my archery club wore it, and he was like, he was old enough to remember milk rations in the war.
Mm.
So
he probably just thought it looked cool.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what I'd wear.
But they're not necessary, and I don't understand how they're useful. Then I don't get it.
Well, I think we've established that they can look cool, but yeah, I think
like it shouldn't. And if you've got really, really big breasts, maybe they get in the way, but then you'd be moving them with a bra anyway, so I don't understand them.
No. But the tab, though.
Yeah. The thing that made me really antsy, because, I mean, I'm not the world's authority on archery.
Can't take her anyway.
Shush. I was an archer, well, I was a member of an archery club. For 3 years, I think, two of which I was an assistant coach. So if this is a legitimate way of using a tab, tell me, because I do want to learn. But nothing that I've experienced within the archery sphere has suggested that it is. A tab is a piece of leather with two holes cut in, which you put your fingers through. It's small, it's about 3 inches by 4, and you use it to protect your fingers from the abrasions that the string will cause when you release it. A shelf tab is basically the same, but with more structure. A normal tab will be used when you're shooting without a sight. I didn't notice whether she was shooting with or without a sight. Without a sight is called bare bow. But the suggestion from all of the kit that she was using, because she had stabilizers on and everything, is that she probably was using a sight. So we'll assume that she is, because otherwise she shouldn't be using a shelf tab at all. If you're using bare bow and a normal tab, you'll pull to the corner of your mouth. If you're using a sight, you will pull to under your chin, which means that the string bisects your mouth and nose. It lies just on the tip of your nose, and if you stick out your mouth, it will go down the middle of your lips. And the shelf tab is solid in a sort of T shape. The upright part goes on your hand just about where your fingers start being fingers instead of palm, and the flat top lies along the first joint, really, of your index finger on the hand that you pull your string with. And that's there so that when you pull to underneath your chin, you can feel with the solid tab, you can feel where it is underneath your chin, so you can get to the same point every single time. If you have a good stance and a regular motion in your pull, if you can get your string to the same place every time, then your arrows will release in the same way and they'll all reach the target in the same place. Then once you have a good grouping, that's when your arrows all strike in the same place, then you can adjust your sight so that every time your arrows will all achieve the gold, which is what you want. That's how you win and get to the Olympics and so on. So she's using her shelf tab to make the fingers... How can I explain? When you knock your arrow and pull the string, you're not holding the arrow. You should not be touching it. You should not be touching the knock of the arrow at all. You want one of your fingers above, two of them below, and those are the only fingers that you touch the string with. You just separate them by yourself by understanding how to move your hand. You don't need any apparatus to keep your fingers apart. You just, am I touching the arrow? If I am, then I move them a bit. But she's got her shelf tab between her index finger and her middle finger, so it's keeping them apart so that she's ensuring she doesn't touch the arrow, because if you touch the arrow, then it will go off course because you're affecting it with your body. And you don't want that. You want it to go straight forward every time and achieve the golds every time. And I don't understand why you would... Like, if there is a reason to do this, a legitimate reason to put your shelf tab between your fingers, then I don't understand... Like, I don't think there is, because it also, it's ruining her release, because when you release, you want your hand...
Make it harder for herself.
...to, you pinch your shoulder blades together, your elbow shoots back and around so that your arm is flat against, like, in a line, your body is forming a line, your front arm is out towards the bow, and your back arm is it's directly behind it. So your hand that's been holding the string to down the middle of your face, that's been under your chin, just relaxes. It doesn't let go, it relaxes and just flies back with the motion of your elbow and the motion of your shoulder blades. It's a very, very graceful motion. It needs complete rest. Like, you don't want any of your energy to be retained in your body or in your stance or in how you're holding your hand. You want it all to go into the arrow so that the arrow will fly true. But if you've got a shelf tab between your two fingers, then you can't relax your hand, you can't let it go limp, because there's a big chunk of plastic there that's making it uncomfortable, and that will affect everything, because you need everything to be in harmony when you release your arrow, or else you're just messing it up for yourself. So basically, it was silly and wrong, and I didn't appreciate it.
That is why she didn't manage to kill the fan guy, because she was doing it wrong.
Well, that's why she didn't get to the Olympics.
Yeah, harsh.
Wow. A lot more involved than I would have thought, but I guess most things are that way, right?
Yeah.
I suppose so.
Okay, well, archery class notwithstanding, that was interesting.
Good.
No, it really was. It really was.
Just facts.
Let's see. All right. I have a couple more things. This is about Maya, or the queen. Did she affect Otoyo because of her beauty, or because he is a Fangire? Do all the Fangire know each other? She can't be Watcher's mother, right? Like I said, does she break the rules, or what? Her introduction and, like, knowing a little bit about what she does definitely complicates everything in the show, I think.
How do you mean?
Oh, it, to me, makes it seem like, because there is this structure of the Fangires that I know about, and she was going after this lady to kill her because she was marrying a human, it made it seem like the Fangire all have some sort of innate sense for each other, and maybe they all know where each other are, and kind of some sense of what each other are doing, or maybe the high ranking, however creatures are ranked, like the high Fangire have like some sort of deeper connection maybe like a psychic connection or something to the other Fangire and what they're doing, and like she was able to seek out this lady to stop her from breaking the rules because of that connection. But then the whole thing with her and Otoya, and could she be the mother, and it just all, it raises a lot of questions.
It changes a lot of the field, I think, for people who are trying to work out who's, you know, had a kid with who.
Yes.
For what it's worth,
yes.
I do think we're meant to interpret Otoya as acknowledging her as having beauty that rivals Yuri's. I think, you know, this is meant to be the one time when Otoya is perhaps as serious about a woman as he has been about Yuri. Because he says afterwards that she shook him up, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he made a weird comment, like, she shouldn't have been able to get to me because of who I am. And it's just like, well, what does that mean? Who are you? What is it about you?
I think it's different from how he feels about Yuri.
Sure.
I don't think that his opinions and attentions of to Yuri are really very different to his usual ones towards women in general.
No, maybe.
It happened, like, they happen to have maybe a better or a more intellectual connection, maybe, because Yuri is Yuri.
Hmm.
What a phrase. They always say that.
Hmm.
That wasn't natural at all. I think it's different. I don't think that Yuri... don't think that Yuri is special to Otoya in the romantic sense.
If I may return to a previous metaphor, Maya is a very different song.
Yep.
And possibly just a whole different genre of music than Otoya's used to. So, yeah.
Is she pro rock?
Oh, yeah. She's rock. Yeah. I think, you know, Claire is onto something. That Yuri maybe was the queen of the world he was used to, but the new queen, no pun intended, I think Maya has destroyed his sort of preconceptions of what an attractive woman can be. Which is interesting, because it does seem like witchcraft, doesn't it, almost, with this black-clothed woman. And it's like, why does he like her? What's so great about her? Well, that's how love is.
Yeah.
And that's one of the best things about a toy is that laugh that you're going to see. You can't justify these things. And I think it does it does some good stuff with that.
Alright, should be interesting. I just don't know what else to say. More good stuff. The last moments between Yuri and Otoya with Jiro watching from afar. That was fantastic stuff, like we said earlier. But I believe you have more to expand upon that?
Yeah, what did you get from it? Like, what did you think that he was...
I don't know, it was interesting. Oh wait, am I supposed to be answering that or not?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I think Jiro saw Otoya as a legitimate threat, but less in a I'm going to win this woman, and more in the manner that, well, maybe Otoya isn't just this ass or clown. Like, maybe there's something good within him that Yuri might legitimately want, not legitimately want, but there might be something there that would be good for her.
He makes
to choose
laugh.
Over what I'm offering, basically.
Yeah. He's got to admit, he makes her laugh. That's something even Jiro probably has to admit. It's nice to be seeing all these potentialities for these people to just become friends.
Yeah. Yeah, what I had to say about that was that here and later, when after the dating party, when Otoya is leaving with the girl he used to know.
A sand woman.
Jiro sees Yuri... noticing that, or sees Yuri sitting with Otoya and leaning on him, and like her basic what about me feelings, because Otoya has been all about her and now he's about someone else, and like it doesn't matter whether she wants him or she's truly in love with him or whatever, it doesn't matter. If someone changes their way to you, you will notice, and if someone is... If someone says that you're attractive and then says someone else is, then you will experience...
That messes you up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Regardless of your reaction, it makes you think...
Like it's not...
Generally.
It's not fair, I think, to assume that it's quote-unquote real.
Yeah, and in this dating party context as well, with this in this situation where you're all expected to have opinions on each other. It's a understandable and kind of cool reaction.
I think that Yuri is sort of snowballed by her situation. A comment that you had from before, Matt, was that she fills the void from the loss of Ixa with Otoya when they go on that crazy date, but then that ends up it ends up in like a moment of tenderness where she actually admits that she is upset and he gets it and doesn't belittle her or anything. That doesn't have to be romantic, but then he doesn't let anything be unromantic. Otoya is not a person who allows his relationships with girls or women to be anything but dating. And I don't think that's fair on her, because any feeling that she has is not sure, because no one is always sure exactly what they think about everything. Like, her mum's dead, we don't know if she has a dad. Her main caregiver is, like, the weird guy who employs her in a cafe.
She's a very complex character, and actually I've just thought, like, can anyone think, and this can be for right now, or for comments for the following week, how many other characters are there in Rider that have an actual conflicted love story like this? Because you're so used to, I think, we're all so used to these fated couples in these shows. And Akiva, not just here, in a couple of different ways, subverts a lot of what we're used to, I think. I think it's brilliant that it seems obvious, because it happens all the time in real life, to have a character have feelings for two different people. But it seems so weird here. And that it shouldn't.
Yeah, and like that they're not cemented immediately as definitely romantic, and she definitely, it's just like she's having some feelings because of the world is happening. And Jiro notices that. He's aware that she's having feelings, and that Otoya like is nice to her when she's upset, and that she wants to be around him sometimes, because, you know, people can be friends. And he's not gross about it. He doesn't, like, bully her about it or gaslight her about wanting to be around people who aren't him.
He's the more mature of the two.
Yeah, he's just like, well, guess I better do something super cool so that she'll pay all the attention to me again and I look really great. Like, I'll propose, or I'll be the coolest guy at the dating party, or he ups the stakes, which... It's kind of an
old-fashioned romantic suitors thing, isn't it?
It's not necessarily unproblematic, but but it's not possessive, and it's not oppressive, and it doesn't.
It could be, but it doesn't happen to be here, right?
Yeah. He doesn't seem to be working on jealousy. Like, he's not upset that someone might think that Otoya would be a good person to spend time with. He just wants to win. And so he's willing to put in the work to impress her and to romance her. Well, kind of, to woo her, I guess. And it acknowledges her as a person more than a lot of romantic plots do, I think.
More than most competitions for a woman's affections do, for sure.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's fun
That just sparked a memory from some movie, Western movie, that... I'm thinking about Aladdin. Never mind, I won't say it then.
Why? What?
Oh, like, Jafar in Aladdin and the Sultan are all talking about Jasmine, and
I am not a prize to be won.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that was so cool. Like, yeah, you're not. Like, and that's so cool that you acknowledge that, and like you make everybody else acknowledge that. It was really, even if they don't take it to heart. I mean, obviously Jafar wouldn't, because he's a evil jerk. But that was really cool. And then I don't know. You can say something more, but I don't know what else to say.
Yuri does say that. Not as many words, maybe in more looks than in more subtle interactions, but the decision ultimately rests with her here.
Yeah. Yeah, he Jiri responds to Atoya's like progressions, I suppose, in his intentions by putting he has to put the effort in. He doesn't have to destroy Yuri's opinions. He just has to make the ones for him better. It's very much acknowledging her own control of her decisions.
Yeah, I was thinking about that while you were saying it. I wanted to jump in, and but now I have the chance. He wants to just show more of himself, or even look at all these other great things I have.
Yeah.
And it's less... They're competing for her, but they're competing to garner her... No,
they're not trashing her while they're trashing each other.
Right.
They're not
belittling
her for having attraction to attractive men. They're just like, well, no, I am the attractivist.
Right, and I can foresee them getting to a point where it's less about trying to upstage each other and just get to this point of, like, raw sincerity. Sorry, this is my writing coming through, I guess. Just, like, exposing themselves and saying, like, look at me. Like, I'm, like, I want you to choose
you know what?
Me.
Can I give you a spoiler that really doesn't matter in terms of plot?
Sure, go ahead.
They bathe together!
Oh, yeah. The bath comes
Atoya
in.
And Jiro.
Atoya and Jiro have a man bath.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Yay.
Pretty amazing.
Alright, why not?
can we not skip episodes 23 and 24? I mean, come on,
Were we going to skip them?
But we're talking...
I had no intention of skipping them.
The slump, he's like, can we skip the slump? But no, because it does...
I'm exaggerating for humour. It's... Prepare yourself, basically, because you're saying all these great things, and they're so true, and it does carry on, but first of all, there's this really weird diversion, and I just wanted to remind you, and anyone who's watching along with us, be prepared, as the scouts say over here.
I think for some people, it would be a deal-breaker.
Yeah.
But I am not willing to let the rest of the series go.
Hold on. Yeah, hold on to it.
I am more willing to...
Wow, we're really building this up.
Yeah, well, headcanon, I guess.
Yeah, okay. I got nothing more to say, because...
Just make sure that you've got a couple more fired up after that, I guess.
Yeah, if you're going to watch 23, watch 24 right after, and then watch 25 quick. I don't actually know if anything good happens at 25, but...
So the crux of the bad stuff is in 23, is that right?
No,
it
24.
It just starts to happen at the very end of 23, but then 24 is just a big, oh no, please stop.
Well, they're all in couplets, right? So I just see it as a two-parter, a bad two-parter. It's interesting because it has a fairly compelling Fangire plot, like the monster of the weeks, the monster of the fortnight is... he bears a lot of analysis, I think. I think he's a bear. I think the bear Fangire. But the other stuff that's going on, the 80s blue sky stuff that's going on, ick. But we'll get there. We'll get there. Oh, Matt stepped away for a minute, so I'm going to take us into episodes 21, 22, and I'm going to be him because I can see his notes with my eyes.
Yeah.
Okay. Comrade Pez, aka Matt, because we don't care for consistency, says, Nago is a crazy jerk.
Mm.
I'm done with that fool.
Mm-hmm.
I think they took his worst qualities and put them into Terrier. Ugh, he says.
Mm.
Terrier.
And I say, ha 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 ha. Yes.
Yes. Mm. No, I think...
Except that Nago is better dressed.
I think you both
have
points.
Hair.
I think what Matt's specifically getting
and
at
funny.
Is Nago and Terry's obsessive qualities. Because they're both so focused on one goal, seemingly.
Mm.
I actually think that's kind of underrating Nago, even at this point, even only knowing as much of the series as Matt does.
Mm.
I think there's a lot more to him. I think if you watch his interactions with Kengo, especially.
Even one thing that... the knowledgeable viewer or listener may draw a similarity between these two characters on. Something that happens much later involving some things to do with The changing
nouns?
Of a name.
Changing of... Okay, right. Yeah,
you with me?
I'm with you.
Better established here. Much better.
Yes.
You can already see it, and the series is only halfway through.
Are you with us, listeners?
You know what we're saying.
Yeah,
don't spoil it for Matt. If you want to, like, argue about that, just come to one of us directly.
Terry, okay, for me, him and Meteor in Forza, they remind me of that sort of Kung Fu movie secondary character where they're just so fixated on this one thing they just have to do. The issue, and both of their stories are basically revenge stories, aren't they?
Yeah.
The issue is, once you've done it, you need more. Mm. You need to grow if you do it, in fact. Hey, how boring is that? A character with a revenge story who gets their revenge.
Mm.
Sometimes it's cool, but in these cases, I don't think it was very interesting. Nago,
though. Who do you think Nago is revenging for?
Well, that's the thing. No, I don't think he wants revenge. Mm. I'm saying Meteor and Axel.
Oh, yes.
Nago is also obsessed with one thing, but it's so much more ethereal and nebulous, and like, what is this one thing? Buttons? Justice?
Well,
both of those fall apart completely in these
episodes.
Nago
has a dead father, but it is his fault.
Yeah.
Ryu had that whole I must avenge my family thing. Nago has no one to avenge it against except the world and everyone in it.
Nago's just looking for control and structure.
Yeah, he's
a much taller
character, yeah. A much more self-perpetuating character.
Like, when you're a writer and you're thinking, well, what motivation do I give this character, however you work, he is trying to avenge the death of his family, screw it up and try again. If it's, he wants structure in his life, hey, now you're on the golden road, okay?
And if you have to
That's
be really specific... Like, he wants this thing. Just make it something he literally cannot have. Because Nago cannot find redemption. That you can't take back framing your dad so that he killed himself. You can't. You have to get on with it.
This is funny. Trying to give a creative writing lecture without any notes. It doesn't suit me at all. But, it's true. Like, if... Sometimes a character can get what they want. But... I don't know if it should... It almost never is exactly what they thought they wanted. And I know that probably sounds cliche even.
Mm.
Because, it turns out revenge is an empty, idle imposition. Da, da, da. But, I think you're probably right, Claire, that people with obsessive personalities in fiction should be thwarted along the way.
Mm.
Otherwise it becomes kind of dull. And Nago, I think the great thing about his development, especially right now... is that obsessive side of his personality is actually falling apart.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to get what he's after because he's stopping caring about what he's after. He's deciding on a new thing. Specifically, he's kind of becoming a teacher. Matt, you're back, right?
Indeed.
Okay. Observe Nago's blossoming relationship with Kengo, okay?
Ah, yes.
Observe it fondly. Nago wants respect. He always has. At the back of things, however many bright buttons he covers it up with, he wants respect, he wants structure, he wants to command, he wants to be sure of things. He just doesn't know how to go about it.
Mm.
Okay? Now,
okay.
Kengo respects him. Ooh, you've already got a little bit of...
Yeah.
You know? He's sighing.
And Kengo,
you're agreeing, because you've seen the rest of the series.
Well,
skeptic here.
What we know about Kengo so far is that he's extremely...
Is he likes to be abused?
No, yeah. He is extremely resilient. Mm-hmm. You cannot crush him. Because we see him first, his bandmates abandon him, and he's like, well, I'll get new ones.
And what... Yeah.
He knows what he wants, and he's gonna find a way. He's a person in motion, and he's self... motivating, even if he doesn't know exactly what he wants.
That's why Watcher likes him.
He fails often, and even if sometimes he feels bad, like he goes to lie on a bench and thinks, well, what have I got now? Nothing. He gets up again.
What did Nago do to Kengo the first time they met? You know?
He hit him.
Yeah.
Well, he gave him water
you know
first.
What?
Yeah, well, that's...
Well,
that's
yeah, that's true.
And,
but then he found out he was a dirty rocker.
But which part of that does Kengo remember? That's the thing about Kengo's character, and he...
Hmm.
His character develops too.
Alright, I'm gonna edit this out.
Okay.
Or a little bit of this out. First, this is staying in. Maybe he's the genesis for Forze, for Gintaro.
Because
he's called Kengo.
he is called Kengo, and he has kind of the rocker punkish, aesthetic, and like he wants to befriend someone, and he's really resilient and super positive,
yeah.
And like he wants to see other people's dreams come true. Like, there's a lot of that in Gintaro, and maybe somebody saw that and thought like, wow, that would be a really interesting writer protagonist. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
they have
probably
a similar
not,
facial
but
structure
it's,
as well. They've got a quite fine bone structure, fine but strong.
I think it's a fair
point.
They
do.
They're both, you know, that sort of informal alternative culture guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and warm and embracing and stuff. And this is where I'll edit out.
Okay.
I think you can kind of see that aspect of, like, the root of Kengo from Kiva.
Well,
kind of gives rise to that.
Gintaro seems more like he's sharing the friendship he has with other people, and he's giving them someone to latch onto. Kengo is looking for Rock, right? Now, he thinks Rock is Nago. Now, Matt, is Nago a good role model?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, I hope you enjoy the ride. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Mm. Okay.
It's pretty crazy.
What did you think of Nago at the dating party?
Oh, man.
I thought he was a huge jerk. I could not believe how judgmental and dismissive and abusive and mean and nasty he was. It was really, really upsetting.
He wanted to go. Mm. Isn't that amazing?
I was just kicking my feet. I was kicking my feet in glee.
Sat beside me kicking her feet. Because, like, he just stands up and just announces his departure, you know?
Yeah.
He doesn't agree to go. He's leading the team now. He's in charge.
And then
he's like Angelica from Rugrats. It's amazing.
It's like,
oh my goodness.
It's my thing now.
It's almost sweet.
Dumb babies.
How into being in charge he is.
Yeah.
Because he's so bad at
it. He is.
When they're going to choose the king by pulling sticks.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I can, me, I can do
he
it.
He takes all the sticks.
Oh, yeah. That made me mad. Like, I'm the king now. And she's like, you pathetic loser. You're not the king and you never will be. You're not worthy of the throne.
I just want to sit him down and give him a cake and teach him, no, we share.
He needs a student.
Yeah.
And he needs to see what it's like to actually have to take responsibility for someone else. And he's going to learn.
I think that why do you think that he agreed to go?
That's an interesting question. To conquer it.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted to take control of the thing,
so?
The nasty business, and make it right or something.
I think he went because Megumi was going.
Really?
Maybe. Are you saying that he really wants her, but only after he's beaten her down?
I'd have to rewatch the scene, but like, does he only agree to go after she?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think. I'm not reading the motivation that you said there. I don't think that he is thinking, I want you to be my girl, Megumi. I don't think that he's aware of himself, but I do think that he is attuned to her. Because he's so immediate. Whenever she says something or does something or suggests something that he doesn't like, he's always there.
She's
and
the
like
closest
when,
thing he has to a rival.
Yeah,
when she'll
suggest maybe she should have Ixa or whatever, his responses are so absolute and immediate.
Mm.
He obviously acknowledges her in some way,
yeah.
And he can't help himself.
Mm. Is the sorry, go ahead.
What was it? No, I've lost my thrust.
I'm sorry. is the Nago Megumi relationship like a dark mirror of the Otoya Yuri relationship?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Nah,
not
at all.
I think.
Are you laughing because I said dark mirror?
Yeah.
Is that what it was, Todd?
It's just a bit poetic, but no. I mean, it's perfect in that they're just two like people who isn't, you know, caught up in themselves. Who keep bouncing off one another in increasingly humorous ways.
She has qualities that he doesn't.
Yeah, I think there's a balance. That's why I say they're more like rivals. There's a balance in Megumi and Nago. Mm. That one scene where they kind of work together is against
was really satisfying.
The Ladybird Fangai, where she throws him Ixa and it, you know,
is that it's a ladybug.
I think so. The one with the cool
wings or whatever.
What's that voice actor's name? Someone out there knows the name of the Ladybug Fangai's voice actor. Awesome. I'm sure it was the Ladybug one.
She's better than him in many ways, and also far more sinful. In his terms, because she's saying, "Oh, a dating party. It's been a while." As if she's been to loads.
Yeah.
And she probably has. So, and he thinks that dating parties are immoral and terrible. And so, you know, that puts her in a certain place in his official pyramid of human sociality. But he can't deny that she's his equal if not in Ixa, in fighting. And like, when she does rescue them, he is not dismissive. He can't be. He has a very genuine reaction of admiration towards her.
Yeah.
So I think that he just...
She's a comrade in arms. He might not, like... he only respects her as little as he'd respect anyone else, I think, in her position.
Yeah. I think that she represents a lot of very interesting and compelling things for him. Yeah. But I don't think that he's aware of it, and I don't think that he's thinking of her as, like, a girlfriend or a prospective partner.
If Nago falls in love, he'll do it in a Nago way. He's not about to slip in, "Oh, yeah, also secretly I have a crush." I think, hey.
That's kind of refreshing. I think that's a good thing.
My brain came back on. For people who care about this sort of thing, the Ladybug Fangai is voiced by the fella who voiced Frieza in Dragon Ball Z.
Oh, boy.
So if you know what that sounds like, then, yeah. Damn good voice actor. Don't care for the series, but awesome voice actor.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. Now we've reached the quota for the show. We have to slam Gaim and Devil and Dragon Ball Z.
Man.
And, there's a few other things.
Check, check.
I'm a hater. I thought we were talking about a series we like.
Oh, yes, we are. Where should we go next? You guys talked about... We talked about Nago. You guys were talking about Kengo.
Let's talk about Kengo more.
Okay.
Because you describe him with three lovely adjectives.
Yes, sweet, charming, and understanding. Oh. I love him even more now. I really do. It was... cool. He had initially had designs for Mio, but he encouraged Wataru to go after her, which was really cool. And I gotta say, what a mensch, you know. I mean, that's like only a good stand-up guy is gonna do that sort of thing.
I didn't ask Pez to use more Yiddish turns of phrase in the show, but I'm really glad he is.
Okay, good.
What a mensch. Yeah, it's a great scene, isn't it? It's weird how quick, actually. There's no conflict. Isn't that great? Like, that's so unusual. Yeah. He just immediately says,
"Go for
it." Well,
like I said, he's self-motivating. He doesn't need conflict to inspire him to goodness.
Yeah.
He does it himself.
There's no argument. Isn't that unusual for a show like this?
For anything.
It should have been dark and brooding. And,
of course.
You know, he sides with...
he joins the Fangires
to try to beat up Kiva.
And they have to have an argument on that riverbank they always have, you know, the grassy slope they always have arguments on.
Right.
In the doramas. Yeah, but he's, Claire said Kengo's.
Kengo's a good friend.
Yeah, Kengo's.
If you are a Kengo, you're alright.
Well, Forze Kengo starts off as a jerk and becomes a good friend.
There's probably a horrible Kengo somewhere just to reverse it. No, there's the scene though with Kengo and Mio. We haven't really talked much about Mio.
We haven't talked about Mio, but, and we should.
Oh, no.
My goodness.
I don't think I like her as a person, but I really like her as a character in a piece.
She is so vital to this story.
Yes.
And I think that the part of the reason for that, at least, is exhibited in her date with Kengo. Because their different personality types are so very clearly defined. He, like we said, he self-perpetuates. He keeps going. He keeps trying.
Gotta move
he
after keeps, eating.
Yeah, he keeps offering her more and so on. Because
he can't offer her nothing, and that's what she wants. That's the thing about a character. You just got to give her space, like any sort of introverted person. But he just has to, oh, it's not working. Here's a different thing.
Yeah.
And that's the complete opposite of what she needs.
But she's similar to Wataru, but they're not the same. It's not just that he's found his Smurfette.
He's changed since
he has, but he is still shy. He's still a meek person.
Yeah.
But they're not identical, which is important. And that's also why I like him and I don't like her as people. Because it's not that I dislike her.
Even having finished the show, because I quite like Mio as a character, and we've discussed this before, things that eventually happen to her, I don't know, maybe I am just like you and think, oh, it's like poetically or whatever, like in a literary sense, it's good. Her role in the thing is good. I don't know, it's hard to separate for me, I think. But no, I mean,
within liking someone as a person, like, do you approve of them or do you want to hang out with them?
Well, I don't want to hang out with any of these people.
Well, yeah.
Monsters!
But Mio, see, her problems with dealing with people, her social awkwardness, I think it's more, I think it's based in overestimating her importance to others. Because she's very, very self-deprecating.
Yeah, she has that thing.
You could stop Kengo by saying, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry I can't eat anymore. Like, I just can't help, you know, you could self-deprecate your way out of being fed more and more. But she feels, I think, that her goodwill or her benevolence, almost, is so important to Kengo that she can't let him down. Because if she says, no, I've had enough, that will ruin things for him. And that's about how she regards her importance to others, as well as how she regards her shyness, like shyness and introversion, and how you like self respect and self assurance and self regard are all different.
When you put it
and
that
they
way,
they all interact in very complicated ways.
I have to admit, it would be harder for me to get on with her in real life. It sounds kind of merciless to just say, like, oh, well, it's that kind of introversion where she should just be able to get over it. But I know that's not what you're saying.
No, I'm not.
It's just that it's the kind of introversion where she really needs to.
I think she's disingenuous.
Yeah.
Because she needs to have the ability to reach out once she's put in a certain position. Like when Wataru comes after her, she gets up and she actively says, I'm so sorry, I got stuff on you. So she's not, doesn't freeze.
No.
She just feels that she needs to grant her favour, I think. And like, you don't need to do that.
Maybe
when
really
you're
dislike
her. Hanging out with people. No, I don't think it's necessarily her fault. I think that's fixable. Like, if you notice that about yourself and you realise, wait, am I actually that important?
Yeah, if you notice it about yourself, that's the thing, isn't it? But I mean, hey, you know, he's having a positive effect on her in a way, in that now she's sticking up for herself, and that's maybe not the right path she needs to take. And I don't think she will take a path of, hey, you know, I need to stop being such a downer on other people. Or I need to stop thinking that my sadness is more important than other people's happiness. But, I don't know. I have a lot of
sympathy for her.
Uh-huh.
But I think that she needs to take the first step.
Right.
I kind of thought she had already taken the first step by the end of the episode with Wataru, episode 22, like when she gets rid of the, you know, clothes or the jewelry and stuff she has, and then she says, well, I'll keep this one because I chose for you to choose this ring, and like, I don't know, it's important to me, but maybe it is kind of what you're saying, Claire, that she's making herself this,
she's
like,
making herself very important, isn't she, by doing that?
That's hella forward.
Yeah, she is.
And I don't have a problem with being forward. Like, go for it. But if you're going to present yourself as someone who is very unforward, then there is a disconnect.
You know what? Actually, now that you put it that way, it let's go all the way to the end. It does make Mio pretty good, a pretty good first girlfriend for Wataru. All right?
Yeah.
That actually, because you need to be able to look back on a relationship and think, well, this is where I started, and this is what this person expected of me, and this is what I expected of them. Good learning learning experience for the protagonist, I think, ahead. So, I think she's a good choice for now.
Yeah, I don't know. I take umbrage, mister.
Anyway, you obviously want, like, the opposite of what I was saying before. You want, you know, when a boy and a girl meet in a work of fiction, they have to fall in love forever. It's as simple as that. Right?
Right.
Get married, the whole nine yards, live forever, you know?
I thought it was kind of funny and interesting, and probably not as much of a mistake as it seems, that she and everybody seem to assume that her makeover would cure her clumsiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny.
Because sometimes in a thing it would, but...
Not in real life?
Well, yeah, not in real life, but also in the story, it's... It's quite thematic, I guess.
Hmm.
You know, you can change how you look, but you are still you, whatever that means.
Well, she kind of acknowledges that, doesn't she, at the end, in a way?
Yeah.
Yeah, she does.
But in such a self-defeating way.
Yeah, oh, hey.
I know, I thought it was hopeful, like, oh, you know what, I guess I'll just have to, you know, start shtegging, make incremental changes instead of expecting to transform overnight, or with a, you know... bat biting my hand.
Yeah, well, maybe
I don't know how much that is coming from a position of experience, knowing where Mio goes.
I'm trying very hard not to cross-reference any of this with anything that happens later.
Okay. Just checking.
Okay. All right. Shall we go on to one of the saddest parts of the show for me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Murder.
Yeah, murder's bad, and it makes me sad.
It's a nice poem.
Yeah, Ricky killing these ladies kind of sucks for me. I'm a little anxious to see this whole murderous monster thing stop, as it doesn't seem essential to their lives, just from the way it's written. It almost seems a preference, perhaps. And I don't know. I think it's a weakness in the writing, because it isn't vital to their lives that they have to eat people's life energy. It doesn't seem like it anyway.
It doesn't seem right. That's interesting.
I like it.
Dang.
Because it makes it more of a genuine tragedy.
Gothic.
Because Ricky murdering these women echoes Dai-chan waking up and realizing, oh yeah, I kill people, and killing everyone who was nice to him and who he liked.
Yeah.
Like, there was no decision to do that on his part, was there?
No, I don't think so.
It was completely, well, I'm doing it.
Well, it was a decision that he didn't make the decision not to, which I think is probably something that's very important to Matt. I'd agree.
But like, that was really raw.
Yeah.
Quite a brave or bold thing to put in a show, and especially a children's show. And I think this is just keeping that alive. Like, it is harsh, but they are monsters.
Yeah.
And no one has told them to stop.
Okay, I think...
Ricky doesn't know anyone.
I think it's pretty clearly supposed to be essential to their lives. I do have a question about maybe what might have caused Matt to take that route, but I think Kiva relies on the most basic understanding of universal monsters tropes, you know, but like, I think we have to accept, yes, these guys kill humans to survive, but by 2008, they are seemingly in prison for their crimes, so thumbs up, but,
well
let me just say what maybe,
go ahead.
What just occurred to me is, specifically with Ricky, that almost humorous way he says, is that part of what maybe makes it seem less necessary to you? Because that makes it seem like the character is taking pleasure in it. If Inoue or whoever, if the writers made it seem more like it was a hard decision for Ricky and Jiro, then would that appeal more to you?
No.
Oh, okay.
If it was
more like Twilight is what I'm saying, would you prefer if it was more... one like that.
Of course I would. No, the issue for me is that I guess in modern times they feed on the Fengar that Kiva defeats, but like,
yeah.
What? What about the castle? The castle needs to eat too, right? Or whatever. It just like, I guess it's too clear. No, it's too unclear and vague that it is essential to their life, to them living, because like, what was Jiro doing? He was choosing not to eat people for a while, it seems like, and he seemed to be fine.
For a while, though.
Was he?
Yeah, but like, humans have to eat like at least every 24 hours, probably, or you'll starve to death.
No, wait, hang on.
We're not long-lived,
That's an interesting point, though. How long is it that a human can go without eating? Isn't it quite a long time?
It is quite a long time.
Yeah, isn't it like...
I will get hungry and thin, but...
Yeah, and not when you're like running around and... being sexy wolfman.
No, like Clef said, we're not sexy wolfman.
It hasn't... Ramon is a child, and he is 100 and something.
Yeah.
So, the lifespans
have something different
here.
Is it like how an alligator can go like a month without eating?
Yeah, maybe.
I think the rules are a little different, aren't they? Well, there's that classic...
Jiro has decided like he has a real desperate task that he's trying to achieve. And that is what inspires him to take a snack break.
Well, there's that classic
Ricky
werewolf
doesn't
thing.
Have that impetus. And they're all endlings, which is probably pretty hard to deal with. So don't want to like give up smoking when you just had your heart broken.
And when you're fighting for the smoke clan. But it's actually just like that classic... it reminds me of that classic 70s, 80s werewolf movie thing. Well, that's like where the discussion came out of. The idea of a werewolf like eating a person is ridiculous, because even a human-sized wolf could not eat that much at once, and if they did, it would have massively horrendous effects on their internal organs. They wouldn't be able to move, and so like, yeah, maybe we don't know how it works, because what Jiro specifically does is like he cuts the soul out of a person, doesn't he, and then he feasts on the soul. Who knows how filling a soul is?
So these are
the kind of discussions we need Colton for, because this is a hypothesis situation where you're dealing with like the fictional science, and like if there's some source book that says, you know, Garuru has to eat this much life energy to survive this amount of time, fair enough. But
if they weren't eating people, what is the point of them being a monster?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I don't know.
I
have no answer.
What makes
them
monstrous, other than... I mean, because you could say, well, they have this other form, but, like, so what then? What's it for? What's the sacrifice that they're giving to be given this extra form?
The monster form
with the Kamen Rider, there's always something.
What's hard to maybe remember is the monster form is the true form. When we, like, it's funny, we say Ricky, we mean Dogger. That's the Franken guy, and Ricky is a human disguise. Maybe that isn't expressed well enough. I mean, that might be a good point. They don't appear in those forms in the intro, do they? They all appear in their human forms around Wataru on the throne, I think, if memory serves. Mm-hmm. And so you get much more acclimatized to their human characters and start seeing them as humans. Maybe it doesn't do a good enough job of showing them being monsters. I don't know. Big question.
Do you watch much horror?
That's a good question. Yeah, that's interesting.
Not anymore.
I've always generally been like it's there, so it seems natural. But
Matt's full answer.
Well, just
I thought you were gonna say like not since I had kids, like because I can't find time.
No,
okay.
No, it was before I had
children,
before I married even. Although I did go see Jason the like 2010.
I think we're talking more about classic classic horror rather than like
okay. Yeah, no, none of it, just because, I don't know, I felt at a certain point that it wasn't something I needed to ingest anymore. I was at one time, and this isn't classic horror, like really, really into Evil Dead.
Okay, The first one?
The first. I liked them all.
I was going to say, because the first one's kind of the black sheep, I think, according to a lot of people.
Oh, no, it's quite effective.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying it's not effective, but like I think people mostly remember the second one.
I mean, the second one greatly... I mean, if you want to do an Evil Dead podcast, we can. I think I can still talk about it extensively.
Groovy.
But Yeah, the first one definitely stands on its own, has a lot of merits. The second improves upon things and whatever. But yeah, it just after a while, it was like, you know what, I don't need to be taking this in anymore.
But I think,
and then I stopped.
It is an important.
I still appreciate things of the horror genre, like the suspense and things like that. But go ahead.
It's an important distinction because all of your references there, well, all two of them, Jason, Evil Dead. You're talking the sort of like 80s revival. Gore.
Yes, terror? Slasher and gore.
Gore stuff, yeah. Whereas, I mean, when Claire and I say horror, we mean definitely pre-80s, Universal and Hammer stuff and anything that derives from that. And that is explicitly what Kiva draws on.
Yeah.
It's got, like, the Holy Trinity. I don't know if I can... Can I use that term in front of this guy? I don't even know.
Oh, I think it's hilarious.
Okay, it's
hilarious.
Got, like, the Unholy Trinity of monsters. Wait, it's probably four. Okay, but it's, you know, it's got a Frankenstein's monster... Dracula's, werewolves, A Creature from the Black Lagoons is, and later mummies, and like, those, what do they all have in common? Universal owns their copyrights.
Mm.
They're explicitly old school, based in Gothic Dracula, Frankenstein, Gothic novels. The original short stories, I think the mummy was based on a short story, so if I'm wrong, and the Wolfman wasn't. But the original short story on which the mummy was based was influenced by Bram Stoker, I think, as well. Somebody correct me on this. It's been a heck of a long time. But, they all draw from the same well.
And it's very similar thematic stuff as Kamen Rider, the original.
And you're not going to see Jason influenced monsters in Kiba. You're going to see these monsters that are based on these classics, right? Think about Jason is... okay, now someone's going to correct me on this because I don't know much about the post-80s stuff. Freddy Krueger, Michael Myers, and these kind of characters. When I think of them, I think of monsters, right? Unholy killers.
Okay.
Dracula. Larry Talbot, the Wolfman.
And even the mummy.
Even the mummy. Sure to end up in someone's tummy. So anyone gets that reference, you hit us up. What's the mummy's name? Imhotep, right?
Depending on...
That's the interesting thing. They all have these real names, and it's because they're real people. They all have a tragic backstory.
Yeah.
They're all... Okay, now, Dracula, it's arguable. We can get into that some other time. But they all have a curse. And I don't know if this is applicable with Freddy Krueger and Michael Myers and their ilk... So, I mean, Matt, do you know? Like, or are they just evil? Because...
No, well, like, I don't know. The Michael Myers canon... The Michael Myers canon kind of changes. Like, he's born evil and BS and witches and stuff like that. Freddy Krueger is kind of like almost like a vengeful spirit because,
he's a child
murderer or molester.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of the parents in the neighborhood, like, burn him to death because he was a janitor or something in a furnace in a boiler room.
The Wolfman can't
and
help
then Jason...
It.
Oh, should I say Jason or
yeah,
not?
Go ahead. If you know it, I thought you were running out.
Yeah, no.
He's got them all.
He, there you go. He was a child, of course, in the original canon or whatever of it. He was a child who died because teenagers, he died at camp because he was left unattended because... the teenage camp counselor people, whatever, were, like, going to have sex in a barn or something.
I guess that's somehow...
It sounds so seedy.
I guess that's somewhat tragic.
And
they all sound like post-2000 retcon origins, though, rather than the original.
Yeah, film. Yeah, they kind of do. And, like, in the original, it's Mrs. Voorhees. It's his mother who actually is the killer.
No, I do know
and
that,
then, like,
yeah.
At the end of the movie, it ends up being, like, there's a jump, a final jump scare before the credits roll, which is, like, this hand jumping out of the water and, like, grabbing the girl because she's dreaming. She's having a dream after the horrible event. Go ahead, sorry.
Okay, because, like, maybe it's not that different, and maybe it's a debate for a whole podcast, but, like, when I think of those universal monsters, I think of humans who have been cursed.
Yeah, basically decent adults who have had circumstances... mess with them.
Except maybe the creature. But,
no,
like,
the creature... Because he was fine, and then
humans
came, and humans are the curse.
Yeah.
And they just won't leave him alone to let him be, and so he has to, you know, tell them to go away quite forcefully.
It is stronger than this thing you call evolution. Yeah, like, it's their fault. It's a curse. That's a good point. And the creature and the mummy both kind of kill for love, you know, in that terrible 40s, 50s kind of way. So I think that's explicitly what Kiva's drawing on, and you kind of have to accept as read, you have to take as read that,
yeah,
yes, all of the 13 monster tribes, they're killers, and it's weird.
It's not their fault, like, it's just, like, for an, for an accessible example for comparison.
No, it's creeping me out now.
The Brendan Fraser, the mummy, from 1998, I think.
You love that.
Now that I've seen.
I do, I really do. In that, Imhotep is the mummy, the evil villain. But every murder that he does is done directly because of the curse that was placed upon him during his trial and execution. He's not actually, you know, like, some nutter who wants to torture and kill people for fun. He has to do it because he's compelled by magic.
What excuse? But no, I think...
Our favourite reason.
That's
these characters.
It's
like,
creepy,
they just
though,
have to.
In this kids' show, to see these people getting murdered because they have to. How are we supposed to sympathise with these characters? And
I think that's the crux of my issue. It's so hard.
It's maybe a good point that isn't delved into enough, but like I said, I don't know if you brought this up, but it definitely occurred to me. By 2008, they are sealed within Castle Drad, and they only come out in the form of weapons to help Kiva fight bad guys. So, justice?
I don't have a problem with it, because they are different.
Okay, I'm
not even wanting to ascribe justice or injustice. It's just,
I was hoping you
like, look,
be the
I can,
arbiter with the scales in your hand.
Hey, you know. I'm not even sure what... You could be referring to, like, three different things with that when you're talking about me.
Yeah.
So, I just... I don't know. Like, you don't have to be eating animals, you animal killers. Like, eat vegetables. Like, I don't need to eat babies or other people to live and survive. Like, I have other options. And it just seems to me like they kind of have other options for what they can ingest to keep themselves alive.
You know,
and... I don't know.
It really would have bigged the series up for me. One thing I complained about to Claire, which I guess isn't a spoiler, really, when we restarted watching Kiva, I thought, I just remembered how disappointing it is that Ramon and Ricky don't really get their own character arcs. And it would have been kind of nice if each of the three monsters, like, to earn a place in the castle or whatever, to earn, like, some peaceful life where they don't have to worry about, you know, making descendants or whatever, if they had to do, like, give up.
Wait, hold on, huh? What kind of life is a life where you don't have to make descendants?
Oh, all right. Hey, it's just a life with protection. You know, they can still have fun, but they don't have to worry anymore, and that's... Castle Drown is interesting, actually. Is it hell, heaven, or purgatory? I'm not really sure for them.
It's Castle Drown.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jura's already said at this point that they made a promise to Atoya.
It was really interesting.
They've always expected to be long-lived, because they are long-lived.
Mm.
Like, for them, it's not... Like, they're essentially in a hotel.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a problem for them. They don't necessarily foresee... I mean, Wataru won't live forever. Do they have to stay after they finish helping him?
No, I see. But they help the next one, don't they? They help the next Kiva. But it's definitely...
Yeah, I guess it depends what
the promise
is. It's
definitely not... And, like, you know, by the year 3000, there's, like, 20 monsters in there, and we've got a Kiva spin-off. But they definitely don't have to kill anymore, do they, in the present day, so...
But that's because they feed upon the fungi that come through.
Yeah, but the decision is taken out of their hands. They're not committing crimes anymore. They're helping... And Wataru is more trustworthy than them, isn't he? So he... You know
well,
what I'm saying, again?
But what about Uhura?
Yeah, what about Uhura?
Well, they ate him, right?
Did they?
Well, they must have done.
I don't remember. No? Wait. How did Uhura die?
He smashed up in the river.
Who killed him? Ixa.
Nago.
Yeah. Did nobody eat his life energy?
But where did it go then?
I don't know.
Maybe it's that's going to be the third Kiva.
No, I didn't. No, I'm saying, like, I don't think anybody got it. I don't. I really think that there's some. That maybe this is the intention. That now they're serving someone that is good and that will try his best to not make mistakes and kill innocent people. I
but we've already
You really want Wataru to fail, don't you?
No, I just... We're already seeing more nuance in Fangaya personalities.
Yeah, it's true.
But so, is it worse just because Fangaya kill people? Is it worse to kill them? And if it's not, then what's the problem? And if it is, then we'll just eat mean people.
I wish you didn't raise these questions. We're going to have to wait and see. I hate that phrase.
Mm. No, at least... Well, never mind. Yes, well, it can be said nicely, or it could be said... what is that? Condescendingly?
Mm-hmm.
At least you're saying it condescendingly. I mean, nicely, not condescendingly.
Let's wait and see what Kamen Rider New Kiva, and yes, that is his real name, does with the armed monsters in...
It's
the inevitable manga spin-off that never came.
It's always a trouble, though, when people try and do allegory murderers. Because always be some who are friendly, and then it just gets very murky. Like in Buffy, it totally did.
Elaborate?
Well, the Slayer kills vampires.
Right.
Sometimes vampires also hang around, and they're kind of friends.
Okay.
Do you just murder your friends?
No, like,
so
well, yeah,
no, of course not.
You have to address that issue in the story. And
sometimes
I think...
if a demon is there, then she'll just be like, right, well, it's a demon, so I kill it. But then sometimes there are demons who are just nice, like Clem.
And like,
you just kill
well,
him.
Like
no,
I said,
you don't. You let him
no,
babysit your sister. So then where is the line? Are you just, like, a weird
well,
judge murderer?
Yes.
I mean, doesn't it...
Exactly, and that complicates the whole matter.
Maybe.
When
I think it's a shame the series doesn't delve into it more. As I said.
That's it, Todd. Your mission is to move to Japan and end up working for Kodansha and write the
here.
Sequel manga.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, I will. I'll do it.
Okay. All right. I think we should move on from here.
Yes.
It was an interesting discussion, but I don't know what the resolution
could
be.
Well, I've brought up Kamen Rider New Kiva, the idea of new blood, to try and segue us into talking about romance and reproduction.
Okay, very good. I was a little bugged by Megumi.
Sorry, Grease 2 up in here.
Okay. Wow, Grease 2,
Grease
huh?
2.
Where do you think right, Cool Rider comes from?
If you, Oh, there you go. Well, if that's what you want to do with your life, that's okay.
Thank you.
Jeez.
Sorry, in fairness, I haven't seen it all, except for I believe somebody was trying to have sex with a girl in a bunker.
Don't worry, it's not good.
Oh,
like a
no,
bomb shelter,
yeah, that, yeah.
Which, like that's not a bad idea, I guess.
Moving on.
Anyway.
A dodgy scene.
Okay. All right, let's see. Actually, I have to retract that. That is bad. Bad teenager. Anyway,
yeah.
Moving on. He's only doing what comes naturally to him, though, right? So I guess it's okay.
Oh, don't you
according to certain people
well,
on
yeah,
this show.
Because,
anyway.
In the movies from the 40s, that's what teenagers did. He's done it. He's turned it back on us.
Okay, so Megumi putting Watcher and Mio together was a little distasteful to me.
But her expression was so funny.
Yeah, I just thought it was funny.
Yeah, I guess. But, like, why do they need romance and love?
Because they have it already, obviously, and they're too stupid to do it for themselves.
Oh my goodness, you're a matchmaker, aren't you?
I guess. I get it with Yuri and her suitors, but is it really necessary here? Is my question.
Well, Wataru is 20, and when you're 20, often you get a crush.
I really want Ishizuka to be involved in this little story scene more.
That would have been cool.
She comes in.
She does, I know, but I think she should have
been
involved
already. Wataru, shy people desperately yearn to learn how to get kissy with someone.
Yeah.
And if Wataru can help them,
so, like,
then that is all to the good.
Megumi can help. Oh, you meant Wataru can help.
Yeah.
Oh, I
like,
see where you're going there.
If seeing
yeah.
Wataru manage it can give them a few pointers on how to not
I think,
just float
I think Matt's being a very good parent here, but I think that, I don't know, because I was... I've never really been shy, so it's hard for me to say that, oh yeah, that would be the right thing to do, but I also have never been Megumi, I wouldn't have done that, I don't know where I stand on this one, really. It's not like me to accept this sort of matchmaker cliche, but I just totally accepted that, yeah, she's being friendly, she knew it would work, and it did.
And it's a relief,
so it's all
because,
good.
Like, Kengo takes 2 seconds to get over it and be a good friend.
Yeah.
And that's a relief. And again, Megumi sees that they have an attraction for each other. They're suited to each other. She's like,
yeah.
Go on then. And so then they can't pretend it's not there anymore.
That's funny.
Because people can be very annoying before they both admit that they fancy each other, especially in fiction. If the shy people can just acknowledge that they have a connection and then work their way around it naturally, but without having to pretend to save face that they don't, then that is all to the good.
I think it's safe to say that Matt wants to see them fall in love, but he just didn't like Megumi butting in like that. It's
going to
happen.
Yeah, and I guess
naturally.
I kind of feel like it's the obligatory sex scene in the action movie.
Okay, right,
I just got a little bit of that flavor, like,
I see where you're coming from.
And it's funny because I really enjoy all the romance in the show, but maybe it's just the forcing of it.
Do you know what's funny about that scene, about the forcing?
Yeah, this but it's understandable because of them being reserved people.
This is Megumi's most Nago-esque scene.
It is, you're right.
She's taking control. Something to think about.
And look, the look in her eyes, she's almost drunk with power.
Oh,
maybe that's why I didn't like
it. She's been literally drunk with whiskey before. So.
Where do you think Wataru would have gone next without a romantic entanglement?
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Maybe he would have... actually, maybe his growth would have floundered, which, like, that's my natural response, but I paused because I don't want to say that because I'm letting you win.
yes.
It's fiction, you know, it's a microcosm. He needs to go on this, he's got, like, coming out of his own shell, society, then he's got to make a friend, then he's got to get a mentor, then he's got to get his ambition, then he's got to fall in love, you know, it's all
He's already done parenthood.
Yeah.
Let him have the nice parts instead of just the hard parts where your child grows up to murder people.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, it's okay. It's just, I don't know. I complain about it, but I really do enjoy the relationship formed between the two of them, and I hope it continues. And I actually get the sense, unlike with Kengo, that this is going to continue, and I'm looking forward to seeing her in a few more episodes, maybe. I mean, in a few episodes from now, I look forward to seeing her. Something really cool, though, I don't know if this was acting or direction or what, but I could feel the butterflies when Wataru was putting the ring back on her. Something about the way the camera panned from the ring to her face, or, yeah, from it, like him putting the ring on her to her face, and the way they acted gave me lovey-dovey chills. So that was really cool.
Well, he's, like, quite good at that.
Romance.
I've seen many GIFs of Seto, what's his face, in various things.
Seto.
He is an accomplished... romantic hero.
All right. Yeah, no, it was a really good, it was a really well-shot romantic scene, in fairness. Proper stuff.
Yeah. Here's my next big thing. I hope you guys don't freak out on me, but Jiro, Yuri, and Otoya make a great couple.
OT3.
I guess so.
I see where he's coming from, yeah.
And I'm not, like, you know, writing fan fiction about the three of them, you know, getting it on or anything. It's just, like... the three of them, it works so well, and, like, I'm not a fan of couples having, like, a friend.
Well, it's a love triangle, isn't it? It's pretty straightforwardly...
yeah, it is, but it's really great to see them together, but it has to get resolved, or else it's not good.
Yeah. But, I mean, do you want them all to stay friends, or what?
Of course I do. Okay. Yeah, I definitely want, you know, someone has to concede or accept Yuri's choice because, like, she's a person and you need to respect her decision. But then after that, just, like, I'd be okay if there was a cooling off period or a period of separation after she chooses whoever, and then we get to see the three of them come back together and have, like, have a drink or something.
You know,
and just, like, have a good time.
All this talk of love, it's amazing that there's these two romantic... plots, I almost called them subplots, but they're really not, going at once. And it makes me think, I talk every other podcast about how much I love Showa, but man, none of these writers get to fall in love. That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
At least not off the top of my head. It's a real shame, it's a real weakness of that whole era, I think, and I really wish there was a lot more of it in Rider in general. I wish there was a lot more of everything in Rider, because I think it can do it. It doesn't just have to be fight scenes and philosophy, you know?
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, specifically the three of them. Their scene with the ring was really awesome. I'm now more in favor of Jiro and Yuri, despite the fact that Yuri seems to have warmed to Otoya.
He's flip-flopping all over the place. He can't...
Yeah, but she's just... Like, just because you warm to someone doesn't mean you want to go to bed with them.
Yeah. I'm still in the kind of neither camp.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't... You know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah, I don't think that either of them are a love match for her right now.
But that's cool. I
like
that.
I don't think Otoya would ever be.
Okay, and that's fair, but, like, she rejects them, and I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because I don't feel... It's really weird. I want her... No, don't. I have to rephrase that. I want there to be a settling down of the romances between somebody. Like, somebody. At least Otoya and Yuri have to get married off to somebody. And it, Jiro might be out of the picture completely, because he might not be who she marries and has Megumi with. I realize it's a very strong possibility, and it looks like Otoya might be ending up with somebody else. So they could all, the three of them, kind of go separate ways and just remain friends. And I'm happy with that, although I know things need to happen and people need to make babies.
Yeah, but it's because you know about that Otoya and Megumi exist. It's that tying up the past thing again. It's that point B thing. Well, it has to happen, doesn't it? You know?
But the I choose me moment is very... Well, I think I mentioned before that it's very much a quality that I enjoy of the Gothic novel. Just because I read it most recently, Jane Eyre, she finds out that, like, she's getting married, and her husband's, well, her prospective husband's brother-in-law rushes in and is like, no, he's already married. So... They all go up to the attic and meet his... Well, she is both mad and cruel.
Just in case you're wondering.
Well, no, but, like, people always say, like, the mad wife in the attic, but he does explain that she is both mentally ill and an unpleasant person. Like, those are separate facts about her. And so Jane, she loves him, but she will not be his mistress. She decides to leave him, and she does leave him because her self-respect and her understanding of herself demands that she must. So she does, and she goes, and she meets some new people, and she's proposed to by someone else, and she refuses him as well because it's not right for her. It's not the life that she would want, and she doesn't love him. And it just is not correct for her as a person.
And it's cool gothic sacrifices, isn't it?
Yeah. That sounds really cool. I want to read that now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's
there's some
it's
good
very
movies
much,
too.
Jane Eyre is a very interesting book, and everyone should give it a try if they like reading. Or there are plenty of movies. There's a Timothy Dalton version for the James Bond fans in the audience.
And Doctor Who fans.
but yeah, it's a celebration, really, that novel of Jane Eyre's self-possession. She goes through the book becoming herself, and she remains herself to the end. And she does fall into the template of a woman who meets man and becomes his bride. But well, it's the same, really. Within the framework of the patriarchy, she retains her self-worth and her self-respect and manages a life that is good and of quality despite being imperfect in, like, the platonic sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a classic thing. Kiva did pretty well on the gothic stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't
impressive.
Get them. Yeah, like, it is impressive that they really did stay true to their motif. I mean, you remember how much problem I had. How much problem.
Yeah,
see, it's
double.
Messed up my vocabulary with double because it pretended to a literary tradition that it did not respect or uphold. But Kiva, it takes the aesthetics, but it puts the work in as well. It's done the research, and it meets the standards.
Mm.
And that is a good thing.
It's Same goes for Gaiman, the Sengoku drama thing, which I actually thought was kind of strong at first, and then now has completely fallen away. Kiva, I think, as far as I remember it, it does stay quite true to this romantic with a capital R, gothic tone and themes all the way through.
It's really quite impressive that it is... it's comparable to the literary tradition that it was spawned from. You can't talk about double in terms of hard-boiled fiction.
People
there's
try,
no point
no,
because
no point.
It has nothing in common with it. There's nothing to say by comparing one with the other because they are different. They don't match. They don't play off each other, and neither of them brings anything to the other.
I think maybe...
But with Kiva, it truly does. It enhances the viewing experience, and it will enhance, probably, your enjoyment of any gothic novels that you have not yet read.
An ambassador would to the fandom of Double would maybe say, Kiva does a better job of mirroring its literary roots, for sure.
Is that you?
Yeah.
Well, now that you've been nice to Double, I'm going to smack it and say...
Okay.
Sorry, I'm not trying to be mean to you. It's just talking about...
Of course.
Talking about, literary trueness. Like, I saw the 70s... like half of the 70s version of The Long Goodbye. And I was instructed to stop the movie after... the Coke bottle smashing in the face scene, because that was too intense for certain parties. In no way does that book, which is outright referenced in the show, have any of its... In no way does it impact the show by being reflected at all, because I'm pretty sure that Philip Marlowe has to deal with, like, the loss of his friend and finding out whether or not he was a bad guy and all that stuff.
And then his friend comes like, back all I know to is life the... from a little robot bird in the next episode, and he's fine.
Yeah. Great. Like, it's so disingenuous to something that it just calls out to in its...
Yeah.
Within itself, and it's like, why...
Explicitly.
Why would you do that?
Like Kiva doesn't go, hey, I love that book, Dracula.
Yeah.
But Dracula's stink and Frankenstein and Jane Eyre is all over it. Like, you get that gothic feeling. Maybe some people get a detective feeling from Double. I've heard people refer to it as like, oh, it's a detective-style show. Well, I think you need to maybe read more detective fiction and watch more detective fiction, because I didn't see it at all.
People got quite excited about how Stephanie Meyer... spoke about Wuthering Heights as an influence on Twilight.
You know, Faith No More were an influence on Korn. I still know which band I'd rather listen to.
Yeah, I haven't read Twilight. I've read a lot about it, and I haven't read it, so I can't speak with absolute certainty on the matter, but I would say that, well, it's similar to the amount of hard-boiled that Double... has actually comprehended.
Ouch.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Twilight may have done it better.
Than even Double, but still.
Yeah, because...
Still, it's not good.
Because there are actually, you know, people going and falling down in the outdoors and feeling really bad about things, which is something that happens in Wuthering Heights.
Well, we're not Twilight haters here.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't say. I haven't read it or seen it at all, so I will abstain. I think we do need to finish up, though, so I'm going to kind of skip past a point that was made earlier in the notes, because I think we've addressed it already.
I was going to detail how many similarities there were before Gaiman meets Okomon. None. There we go. Oh. Moving on.
Sorry.
Moving on, eh?
Last thing I wanted to say, Otoya as a willing dupe is an interesting choice, and I'm not sure that I like it.
I have a whole paragraph about that. Have I got time?
Go ahead.
Okay, I think that it works because it, air quotes, pardons him for his pre-series crimes. He was a scammer, now he's been scammed, and it really worked for him in another way because Yuri noticed it when she should have been thinking about her own feelings and about whether or not she wants to get married. She shouldn't have been distracted by default jealousy. But yeah, he was a scammer and now he's being scammed. So if he can brush it off, like it's nothing and it doesn't matter, then the people that he wronged, air quotes, should be able to brush off what he did to them.
Yeah, that's what he's
thinking. He has a certain nobility of character, but he's not a straight shooter. Well, he's not a completely honest person.
No, his standards are entirely arbitrary. Like he doesn't hold grudges. You know, I don't hold grudges. But he also doesn't learn from his mistakes.
Yeah, because I've done that. Like, I've decided not to mind when someone has done something to me because I know that I have done it to other people. And I've noticed that I'm doing it, so I've made the decision to endeavour to not do the thing that I did again. But I if I don't allow myself to be slighted, then I don't have to worry too much about what I did. But I don't think he's also deciding to be better in future. I think he's just
much more nihilistic. He respects other people's personal freedoms and thinks they're all equal, but the problem is he doesn't sort of give them the same, you know, he doesn't bother thinking about other people. You know what I mean? Like, he assumes that everybody is playing the same game he is. Maybe a great friend, but a terrible long-term lover. That's the simplest way I can put it.
Yeah.
That's...
Forgiving doesn't learn. Problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
that is really
like you said, it was interesting seeing the scammy ex get scammed, and I wonder if it'll be the last time it happens.
Yeah, I wonder. Is that all everybody has to say?
I think so,
apart from...
Okay.
Hey, we're not going to see you next time because we're not doing these episodes. I refuse. I can't do them.
What?
No, I'll do them. It's okay.
Oh. Slump.
Okay.
The slump! Are you ready?
I'm really nervous, actually.
Good, because then you'll... Like, when it's not as bad as we've said, you'll be really relieved.
Yeah, but it is
the... I guess so. One last note, and then we're out of here. Otoya, Jack Sparrow.
What?
In his mannerisms, he's very loose, and I found myself.
Well, yeah, actually.
Over gesturing, and I thought, "What am I doing?" And then I realized, "Oh, I'm doing wonderful. This." And I thought, "There's something like
I'm being a flirtatious
no,
drunk.
This isn't. There's something. This isn't." There's another source that's influencing me, and then I realized, oh, that's what it is.
There's something liberating about
I'll
this.
I'll do it if I want
Jack
to.
Jack Sparrow has that silly paragraph where he's, well, not paragraph, monologue, whatever.
Soliloquy?
He goes on about how he is trustworthily untrustworthy. Some.
Right, yeah.
And that works for Otoya as well.
Yeah.
He's an ass.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That he phrases it prettily, so it doesn't matter as much.
Everything's pretty on
that
the outside,
he's not actually
but underneath,
nice person,
there's
even
no
though
value.
He can be very kind when he needs to.
I hope he learns a hard lesson.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
People are very complicated.
They are, especially gothic ones.
And that's good to see in fiction. Like,
oh,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna Bukowski. Bring in some more literature.
But
when I read his book, I think it's called The Post Office. I don't remember. Post Office? Something like that. Something about a post office.
He's a very memorable author.
I thought... I read the whole thing and I thought, I'm having a thought. What is it? And I thought that it is the only time that he is... What was it exactly? I've forgotten. I tweeted it at the time. It was good. Like, the only time that he is compassionate or respectful or something is when he's feeling pity. And so he's often quite kind to women, but it's because he has contempt for womanhood. And I think there's something of that in Otoya as well. I don't think he's quite as... unpleasant as
one
Bukowski,
of my best friends.
Maybe.
One of my best friends is a huge Bukowski mark, so I'm gonna have to reassess our friendship.
But I just like that level of people can be many things at once. I think it's evident in Kiva, and I think that is on purpose. I think that is good writing, even though it makes it quite hard to view sometimes because you're not really sure what you're supposed to think, what you do think about certain characters.
He's a cad.
Okay. final thing. Sorry, I know we've ended this three times.
Final?
This is like Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Turbo.
I'm gonna read Castle of Otranto. I don't know how quickly or what, but I read the forewords by the author, and
this is my book.
Oh, that's silly.
It was really interesting. So what's the truth? Did the author... It is really the author's book, or it is a translation?
Well, even...
Or nobody knows.
No, it's kind of a mystery. I actually... that's the kind of thing I would normally try really hard to find out, and I remember studying it, but I never found out the answer to that mystery.
Bit of a Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Okay, well...
Well, good luck with it, because I actually... It's one of the books that I actually bought... to study for my university course.
And then you didn't read it because you thought it was trash?
No, I bought it. No, I enjoyed it. Okay. I got it in Vathek and Frankenstein, The Monk, Dracula, these big classic gothic novels. So yeah,
okay, cool.
Check out as many of those as you can for wider reading around Kiva.
All right, sure. Very good. Man, yes, and with that charge, we bid you adieu.
Say bye.
If you experience any complications, would like to make a testimonial, or have any questions, send your correspondence to uncommoncastrx@gmail.com or contact the Uncommon Crew via Twitter at GomezQ, at Grimhelm, at ASQuay, at ComNerdyPez, at Newsart, at ProfessorWare. Keep an eye on at UncommonRx, where one can receive updates, deliver input, and give feedback. Also, visit uncommonrx.tumblr.com for additional content.